This week's episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by the following advertisers. Get ready to delve deep into a weird world of essential cult entertainment only on Full Moon's Amazon channel. Classic Full Moon and Empire Pictures faves like Castle Freak, Puppet Master, Subspecies, Necropolis, Intruder, Head of the Family, Evil Bong, The Ginger Dead Man, Laser Blast, The Pit and the Pendulum, and Lurking Fear. All of these share space with a wild library of cult creepers from the legendary Blue Underground and Something Weird video labels, the Andy Sedaris and Jess Franco collections, the Eurocine archives, Trailers from Hell, and much, much more. It's an unlimited onslaught of awesome right at your fingertips 24/7. New uncut movies are added every week, and all titles are available in the highest definition available. So get yourself over to Amazon and subscribe to Full Moon today for only $6.99 per month. Your glaze balls will never be the same again. Trust us.
Diabolik DVD is Shockwave's number one spot for demented discs from all over the world. You can check them out online at www.diabolikdvd.com. That's spelled DIABOLIKDVD.com. They're the number one source for horror, cult, and strange films from around the world. If you are looking for rare, unique, and strange films, then you need to head over to Diabolik DVD. Right now at Diabolik, they have all the AGFA titles, including Blood Lake, Lady Street Fighter, and Ninja Zombie. They also have all of the 7 releases, including Death Warmed Up and Escape from a Woman's Prison, and also all the latest from Scream Factory, including The Brain, 7 Golden Vampires, When a Stranger Calls Back, The Chosen, and Superstition. For all of your horror and cult cinema needs, head on over to www.diabolikdvd.com or find them on Facebook.
Fangoria turns 40 this year, and Issue 3 is out to subscribers now. It's 100 pages of exclusive, carefully curated horror content honoring horror's past, present, and future. Fangoria is also getting into music. Holly Doom is a collection of synthwave scores from artists like John Carpenter, Power Glove, Gunship, and more. Holly Doom is available now wherever you download music. Fango's bookline continues. Joining Preston Fassel's Our Lady of the Inferno is Max Booth III's Carnivorous Lunar Activities. It's a bloody romp about the dilemma of what to do when you discover your childhood BFF is a werewolf. Relatable. Carnivorous Lunar Activities is available for pre-order now. Head to Fangoria.com to learn more and subscribe. $60 gets you a year subscription and saves you about $20 off the cover price. So head to Fangoria.com.
The Shockwaves team is heading to Texas Frightmare Weekend, presented by Arrow Video. The event is the Southwest Premier Horror Convention, now in its 14th year. Bruce Campbell, Tim Curry, Robert Englund, Lee Majors, Meatloaf, Joe Bob Briggs, and many, many more, all expected to appear. I expect film celebrations for Halloween, Reanimator, A Nightmare on Elm Street, The Rocky Horror Picture Show, and Evil Dead. Texas Frightmare Weekend takes place May 3rd to the 5th at the Hyatt Regency at the DFW Airport. For more info, visit TexasFrightmareWeekend.com.
This is Shockwaves episode 139. I'm one of your hosts, Rob G. I'm sitting here with Ryan Turek to my left.
Hello.
Hello. Rebecca McKendry to my right.
Sup?
To my far right, Elric Kane.
Yeah, this doesn't feel like
this
normal.
Is a weird arrangement.
We are
right?
We're in a different room than we normally record in. So if it sounds different, it's because we're in the
twilight.
It's
a whole different air tone. This is just weird.
In the twilight zone.
I don't know what to tell you guys.
Ryan's just shrugging, like, whatever.
Whatever. We're in a conference room. It's great.
You know what, kids? It's better than no room at all.
Try to be professionals here, damn it. And we got a great show for you. It's all about Stephen King this weekend because Woo! When this airs, Pet Sematary is out. We have seen it. We're going to have the directors on later today.
Yep.
You can listen to half of the episode with them. And then we warn you about spoilers. We do recommend you go see the movie right away and listen to the second half of their very candid chat about, adapting a new version of Pet Sematary. It's going to be really cool.
Yeah.
I think we need to do that more often with our movie reviews where we warn people just stop, because I feel like we don't often get into the movies without spoilers. Yeah, like you have to get all the way in. Whereas so far in our 170 episodes or whatever, we really try, even though we failed, to be spoiler-free. But I would actually think we should build spoiler episodes because I think there's so much more you can actually get to.
People have been requesting that forever.
Yeah. So anyway, something.
If only we had the time for all four of us to get together more than once a week. Then this would be
well, that won't
ideal.
Happen, but you know.
Well, we'll get to it at some point. I would love to do bonus episodes like that. But so, I don't know. What should we kick off with? Have you guys seen anything in the interim?
I did WonderCon this past weekend, so that was a blast.
What was the scoop there?
Yeah, it was just a fun show. I was on a panel with some of my friends from Phoenix Comic Con, and then also Elise Wax joined, and we were talking about horror of the 2020s, what we see as the predominant trends of the 2020s. So like what's coming, what we think is, you know, what's going to be the cycle, especially for like television versus film. We talked a lot about graphic novels. So, yeah, it was a good panel. I think we're doing the same thing at Phoenix Comic Con this year as well.
Now, I'm going to ask you about WonderCon momentarily, but let me ask you something, Becca, because you've done a lot of panels in the last 10, 15 years.
Oh, my God,
That are all about what's coming.
Yes.
Have we ever gone back to see if you or any of the other panelists were correct about the upcoming trends?
So some of the things I have been, I mean,
it's literally like every other year.
I get put
on coming in hard.
Well, it's always either.
I think Ryan would like to know this, considering his position at this company.
Well, Ryan's done a lot
what's
of them
going,
too.
What's coming up?
I usually do a lot of what's
state
coming.
State of horror.
And state of horror.
Yeah, like
yeah, but
those
me and
are
Rob
two.
Are starting Cinema Police, where we're going to go back to old panels and
like, yeah, compare. I don't know,
so the one
right
thing
here.
That I will say I did call on, like I said, we would have circled back to monsters by now, which we have not. And I said somebody would have reinvented the slasher reel and re-kickstarted it, which I think that Happy Death Day kind of redid the wheel a bit, but it has not kickstarted the slasher return yet, which I'm still saying is going to happen in the next couple of years because we're long overdue for the return of the slasher according to like the standard cycle. What I will say I was able to call was that budgets would keep depreciating because when I first started doing these things, it was like right when VOD was coming out and we were starting to see budgets dropping and I was like, oh, they're going to keep going. And I'm going to say it again, they're going to keep going even more. Is what I was saying. For some, I said that we're going to start to see a real class system. It's either going to be
for independence,
$5 million and above or $500,000 and below. And I think that those are kind of the two schools that horror is going to live in. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Guys, there's a Jim Jarmusch zombie movie. Like, I watched that trailer. I was like, holy shit, that looks like a broad comedy.
Is that Superman real?
That's real.
Oh, that's
okay,
real.
It's real.
That's
okay.
Real.
Yeah, that's a real movie.
We're recording this on April 1st, by the way. Yeah. So I don't believe anything on the
shit.
Internet today.
I thought that was, I thought you were fucking
It literally
with
looks
us.
Like a sequel to Zombieland. I mean, it's got the same tone. It's got half the same cast. Bill Murray. I mean,
he did a vampire movie.
No, I know.
So maybe.
But it is real, because I wouldn't be surprised that Jim Jarmusch would do it.
It's a real movie.
That's legit.
Wow.
That looked funny.
Well, we saw over the weekend the return of Joe Bob Briggs,
who is
kicking off his weekly series on Shudder with a double feature. And on Friday night, he debuted with Chud and Castle Freak. Now, I watched Chud, and you know what? I disagree with Mr. Joe Bob Briggs on giving Chud a 2-star review. So call me a Chud monkey all you like.
I'm a Chud 2-star.
But he was.
As I watched it with Joe Bob, he sold me. Yes, it is a 2-star movie.
Oh, well, I haven't seen it in forever, but I love it.
He did bring up certain things that I did agree with, but it still didn't take away my enjoyment of the film.
I guess.
But watching Joe Bob skewer Chud was like listening to Old Man Turner. Skewer movies where he's just like, what about this and what about that? And I was like, oh my God, Joe Bob, you're really on a fucking tear tonight, man. But it was a really, really great start to the weekly series. I watched the opening monologue to Castle Freak, which began with, we're going to start with Castle Freak. And we got Barbara Crampton on. What a lovely, lovely woman. Castle Freak. Pretty amazing movie. And then he just goes on this tear about Miss America pageants and how they've neutered Miss America pageants and how there's no swimsuit competition anymore and all. Literally, he just goes on it was the greatest Joe Bob tangent I have ever listened to. Ciara and I were cackling. It was hilarious.
Well, my favorite thing is he always says, all right, back to the movie. And then he goes on for 2 more minutes. Every time. And it's like,
well,
it's
that was like
the
tradition. That was always tradition on the old show. He's like, did you ever hear about, you know, it's just like, it's so good. But it was a very warm welcome.
I still had the problem of the loading spinning wheel, I've got to say, sadly.
Oh, man.
Because I couldn't, because I got sick. You guys are obviously about to talk about, the speakeasy, Graham Skipper's.
Yeah, the rated R speakeasy.
And I knew everyone was going to watch it there. I really wanted to make it to it, but I got sick that night. I've been sick for the last 3 days. And so I'm at home going, oh, I'll just watch it. And it just spun and spun. And I just sat there going, oh.
But it's on there now, right?
It is.
Like after it airs, it goes.
But I don't, I guess I don't
Shutter.
Understand the why it keeps spinning. Like why it still doesn't, you know.
That's that Santa Clarita Wi-Fi.
It could. Yeah, maybe it's a Wi-Fi problem with me.
I think it's you.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah,
you know, it was
haven't
fun.
Had luck with it.
I went. I got together with my friend Scott Reynolds and went to this. Our friend Graham Skipper was throwing this rated R speakeasy, which was basically a giant horror event at this great location. And part of the appeal was that in one room they would be doing a theater. Basically, the theatrical experience of watching Joe Bob. So my buddy Scott and I went early. We got seats all the way up front, and we watched Chud with Joe Bob in that environment, which was okay. Ryan was making fun of me while I was watching on – because I was on my phone.
Old man G over here is like – taking photos and putting them on Facebook, and then everybody's like, why is that person on their phone? I'm like, they're in a bar.
Yes, technically. But no, I went all the way up front. I got there early, and the girl sitting in front of me was playing a game on her phone the whole time. But not only that, like holding it up like this, like towards the screen. So I did video of her for fun. I was like,
get her Candy
Crush. She came to watch Joe Bob and play Candy Crush the whole time. I was like, why are you in this? Go in the other room where Jonah Ray is doing like a DJ set. You know, it's like, we're here to watch Chud, damn it. But it was very thoroughly enjoyable to see Joe Bob with a group of people.
Yeah.
That part was fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the whole thing was great.
Yeah, that night was fantastic. It was a good – it was this horror speakeasy was at an undisclosed location publicly, but if you like RSVP'd, you got a address and you would go. But it was honestly, I had gotten a sneak preview of what was going on, and to see what Graham and the team had done, basically it was just like a kind of multifaceted bar event where it was just like every single horror person was under one roof just enjoying artwork. There was like an art gallery off to the side. There were tacos. There was a woman hanging from sheets pouring expensive drinks and flipping.
Well, wait, not just expensive drinks. Graham wrote to me going, you need to get here before the Cue the Wing Serpent drink that will get poured from above. And I was like, oh, I missed that. I'm like, come on.
Yeah, I missed that too. But it was a really fantastic event. So thank you, Graham.
And speaking of events, because
talking too much about our name dropping? Are we talking too much about personal things?
About Graham Skip? No,
this is
us. This is our show.
Did we get another negative iTunes for knowing name
for
dropping?
For knowing people?
Yeah,
I don't know if people count Graham Skipper as a name drop, but if it is, I think then Graham's made it. You've made it, Graham.
We all know Graham Skipper.
Listen, I watched Plague of Zombie movies with that Graham Skipper, so we go way back.
All right. So Rob, we think about time management, you know, and we think about
I want to go into this
because at the end of the weekend I'm sitting there and I'm like, God, I'm exhausted. I just got done doing some work and I did all these chores. I had all this shit to do. Where'd my weekend go? And then I'm sifting through my Instagram and Rob G's like,
oh, I saw this.
I just went through all the Resident Evil movies. Woohoo!
It's kids.
And I was
they change everything.
No, but I don't know. Ryan, would you go down this route yourself?
You know what? I've tried to. And
I haven't made it past the Vegas one.
Yeah,
I can't get past
Apocalypse.
It was when we were still doing Blumhouse.com. I tried to go back through all of them for an article, and I didn't make it past Apocalypse.
Here's context. I watched all six Resident Evil movies this weekend. It is a franchise. No offense to people that love it. I never got into it. I could never make it past the first movie, and that has more to do with Paul W.S. Anderson than it does with the video game. I've never played the video game. I used to sit and watch my friends play it, and I thought it was amazing because we'd hit the lights off and it'd be really scary.
It
like,
was so much more fun to watch. It was the way that I felt about Silent Hill as well, where I had more fun watching it than playing it.
Well, it's one of those things where, like, my friends and I, when we were in like junior high, we used to play Dawn of the Dead. Mm-hmm. Like, we'd flip the couches and pretend we were in the mall, you know, defending our house against zombies. And so, literally sitting with those same friends when they first discovered the first Resident Evil felt like that. It's like, oh my God, we get to be in a Romero movie. It's like there's zombies coming out from different corners. So I always loved and respected the game. Again, I watched the first movie, and this weird thing happens every couple of years where I saw it in theaters when it came out, hated it.
And the first one?
The first one.
Oh, I thought it was good.
I'll get to why. I've now that I've sat through all of them, I have clear ideas. And every couple of years, I'm like, I'm going to get into this franchise. And I watch the first one, and I get so angry that I'm like, I'm not going to two. I don't care. And then a couple of years goes by, and I was like, I don't remember one. I think I have to start at one again. And I do it all over again. I've seen one more than any of these. Yeah. Long story short, everyone knows I have a 3D TV, and Steve Scarlatta and Josh Miller insisted that we do all the 3D Resident Evil movies, which are 4, 5, and 6.
Right.
I didn't own the final chapter. It didn't come out here in 3D. Yeah. Josh Miller went out of his way to buy it for me from the UK. It was temptation. He's like, look, I bought it. We're going to watch all three of these 3D movies. And so the plan was to just watch the 3D ones.
Yeah.
But then Saturday came rolling around, because we were doing this on Sunday night. Saturday came rolling around. I asked Josh what he was up to, and I was like, look, do you want to do the first three right now? And then tomorrow we'll do the latter three. And he's like, I'm in. So he came over, and we went through this whole goddamn franchise. Ugh. And it was hilarious. I tweeted this, but at one point during the final chapter, I was sitting next to Steve Scarlatta making noises, and he's like, you sound like Nicolas Cage in 8mm. Like the way you're
great. Turn it off.
Is it over yet? Dear God.
George C. Scott.
yeah, exactly.
Oh my God, it's my daughter.
Okay, so the first three, what happened was, I kind of get the first movie, but I still don't like it. And I think, and look, I'm going to defend him later on, but in those early days, Paul W.S. Anderson, not to be, you know, confused with the other Paul Anderson, he is not a good visual storyteller. Like, I couldn't put my finger on why, like, every choice, every angle, every shot, the way it's executed is just not exciting in any kind of – like the first time they reveal zombies, which by the way don't show up for like 50 minutes.
Oh, wait. Hold on. Movie. I just got a text from Event Horizon saying what?
Yeah, whatever.
Okay. Event so Horizon. One film he pulled off. All right.
One, yeah, but you know, anyway, I just think that's the thing that really bothers me about that first movie. There's a few cool set pieces and stuff, but it takes too long to get to the zombies. And when they do – it's the age. I mean, I know I was in the minority at the time, but it's like they don't know what they are. They don't know how to kill them. It's like all this frustrating stuff. It's like, I'm pretty sure we're supposed to shoot them in the head. And you're just like, Jesus Christ, we've done this in so many zombie movies. I have no sympathy for anyone, including Michelle Rodriguez. And Mila's character, who has amnesia. I also love that conveniently, these people don't remember anything, and that's how they get away with the plot.
Yeah.
But like, Mila is more upset about Michelle Rodriguez than she is like her own husband. And so I'm like, I don't know who I'm supposed to care for if she doesn't care about anybody.
Right.
And anyway, the movie just ends, and it's kind of like they name drop all the stuff, which I assume is game stuff.
Yeah, it's game stuff. But one of the
take him to Project Nemesis.
Yeah, one of the
all
things.
All right, I don't know what that means, but here we go.
The thing that Resident Evil, my takeaway from the very first, I mean, like me, and it was Jared Rivet, went to a test screening of it way back in the day, and I think I threw my middle fingers up at the screen when it was like the Dead Walk newspaper flashed on the screen, and I was like, "Fuck you."
Yes.
Well, remember, I mean, Romero was supposed to do the movie.
Back in the day, which was a totally different movie. And I read the script for that.
Yeah, they like – was it terrible? Because that was like Sony was, came out and was like, it was garbage.
It can't be as terrible as the movie they put out.
I mean, it was on par in terms of you know, quality. But my one takeaway from Resident Evil initially was, where the fuck all these people keep coming from? Because they keep introducing characters. Mm-hmm. As soon as that other team come in, you're like, wait a minute, who's that guy? Wait, who's that guy? Wait, who's that guy in the tunnel over there? Because they just like roll all these faceless people in there.
Yeah.
And you're just, you know, it's like exactly what you're saying. It's like, who am I supposed to root for? Who am I caring for? It was weird.
Well, let me just do bullet points for the rest of it, because we'll be here all day otherwise if I complain about this series. So what I realized, what's funny is, as I was posting about this, everyone has different favorites. So people are coming to me saying, oh, 2's the worst one. And then somebody's like, no, 2's actually my favorite. Or 5's the best one. Or 5's, you know.
Oh, wait.
So
I made it past 2. I stopped. 3 is the Vegas one, it looks like. Okay, yeah, that's where I stopped.
So for 1, 2, and 3, they got better for me. I actually liked 2. 2 is Apocalypse. And the big difference here, 2 and 3 are not directed by Paul Anderson wrote them, but he didn't direct them. And so here, right. The second one was actually directed by, I believe, a well-known camera operator / DP. That one is at least is fun. It's super fast-paced. It's really fun and entertaining. You know, there's and ridiculous. There's soldiers. They introduce this character, Jill Valentine, who I assume is in the games. Actually, yeah. We know they're in the games because when she shows up, she looks like Lara Croft, and it's ridiculous and laughable. And we're like, that must be her outfit from the video game. There's no other logical reason for her to be wearing this skimpy thing, like, it's as she gets introduced. Yeah. And so that's kind of like silly. But you know what? They do zombies in a graveyard, and then the Nemesis monster shows up, and he looks
stars.
Like he looks like the Nemesis guy looks like Rawhead Rex with a bazooka.
Uh-huh.
Like, how can you not have fun with that? So anyway, people die stupidly. It's better than one. It's better paced, and it's more entertaining with slightly more likable characters.
It's got Mila running down the side of the building. In Toronto, that's 2.
Okay,
because apparently the building in Toronto.
They all blur now.
all of our Canadian listeners are like, Tarek, understand what the building is. I forgot what a building is, but if you go to Toronto, it's just like it's recognizable, and you could see it. And you're like, that's what Miller ran down.
That was awesome.
Yeah.
Third one was my favorite, and that's Russell Mulcahy.
Yes.
So we're talking about the director of Razorback. Highlander.
And this is the Vegas one.
Yeah. Vegas, but like everything's gone now. Mm-hmm. And so that's the one. It's the best directed. It's the best executed. The zombies are pretty cool. They do rip off Bub, totally.
Yep.
And there's thousands of zombie crows. That's kind of awesome. Finally, some gore. Here's the thing you probably don't remember. The first two movies are pretty goreless, even though they're all rated R.
Yeah.
Like, I was like, oh, what the hell? This is the one that feels like a Walking Dead episode before Walking Dead.
Yeah.
So that one's really good, and it ends with the promise of multiple Milas.
Yep.
Okay, so now we're in 3D territory. My favorites were 3 and 4. Part 4 is Afterlife. And it starts really strong. The 3D is actually amazing. And here's the thing. Paul W.S. Anderson is back to direct the latter ones. He directed 4, 5, and 6.
And can I interject with a reason why? When I had interviewed Anderson at Comic-Con just before this segment.
Fourth one.
Before the fourth one. And I said to him, obviously you're developing a fourth film. Are you going to come back? And he said, yes, because I see my next 3 films as a trilogy, whereas Mulcahy put his stamp on it, closing one trilogy. I am going to kick off the next trilogy of the Resident Evil universe.
All right. Well, he did do that. Here's the thing. Because it's in 3D, and this was actually shot with 3D cameras, not post-converted, it seems like this is the first time I've ever seen Anderson get a grasp on directing because of the 3D.
Yeah.
Like, you could actually – where the camera is and how it's executed, it's like, oh, he gets how action scenes are supposed to play out now and where things are supposed to be staged. So that was awesome. The opening's amazing. There's, like, multiple Milas. They get rid of that right away, which, like, literally
– Wait, so this is 4 you're talking about?
Part 4. Okay. So at the end of 3, she finds, like, a whole thing of all her clones. There's, like, hundreds of them. And then in the opening of 4, she pulls off a stunt where they all die. Right. You're just about to, so it's like, oh, all right, cool concept. Yeah. Done already, the opening. But it's a great opening. And that's pretty much it. I'm bummed that they waste the clones. Zombies don't show up for 30 minutes. Because at this point, it's not really about zombies. It's just about, like, they're just like action spectacles where, like, monsters show up occasionally.
Yeah.
And in fact, they look like Venom. There's multiple Venoms in every one of the movie. I know Avi Arad is probably sitting there like, we could do a Venom movie. Look, they do it every one of these.
You're talking about the liquor?
No, in every movie, there's like a creature that shows up that
some
looks
random
like
creature.
Venom.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, so that was that one. Then we go, nice cast. Wentworth Miller, Kim Coates.
Yep.
There's a pinhead style dude that's straight out of Silent Night. Not Silent Night. What's the Silent Hill?
Silent Hill. Pyramid
yes.
Head, yeah.
The dogs. This is where we realize that the dogs are staple of every movie. We're like, okay, zombie dogs have to show up. I think the franchise may have peaked with part 4. Part 5 has the most amazing opening sequence because it's all backwards.
That is actually that's my amazing. Favorite thing. And the score to that is excellent.
It is, but it's my least favorite movie. Because yeah, after that opening, the movie is terrible. They're in some sort of virtual environment where there's zero stakes. Yeah. She's got a daughter. They brought back Michelle Rodriguez for no reason. And it's crazy. And then the final chapter retcons everything. There's a bunch of Blade 2-ish vampires that have these things coming out of there, which I assume is a video game thing again.
Yeah, because they were drawing from inspiration from Resident Evil 4.
Yes.
Yes.
The 3D improves, but now there's more shaky cam stuff. There's winged creatures. Great sequence on a tank with the zombies chasing Mila. But I don't know what's going on in this franchise anymore. It could be because I watched six in a row. And I just want to say that who's the guy that directed Cube?
Vincenzo Natale.
I hope they're paying him something because they go back to that Cube gag from part one over and over and over again, this entire franchise. So I've done it. I did all six. I never want to watch them again. If I wish I do, it'd be three or four maybe.
I'm going to send you a medal. But by email, so I'll send it to you like a gold
Thank
star.
Thank you, I appreciate that.
Before we leave it, I want to go do like a shot-by-shot comparison between the video games with each film. So let's starting at one.
Okay, here we go.
Actually, no, I didn't know the video games at all, really. So.
Well, you know what?
I only watched the first movie.
Here's the thing. I actually want to talk to a diehard fan of the video games and ask them how they feel about these movies. Because there's so many little bits in the movie that – like, you know, because Josh is a screenwriter, so he always watches these from a writing perspective. Mm. And I watch it as a fan. And we both are like – okay, so there's no reason for this to happen, but that must be a video game. Like, if I was a fan of the video games, I bet this character showing up must be really cool right now, but it makes no narrative sense. Hmm. So, yeah, we kind of gave up by the end of it. But
I was an apologist for the Resident Evil film franchise for a little while, and I think it got up to Extinction, which was Russell Mulcahy's.
Yeah.
And it was around four when I started losing track. And by the very end, my brain was just mush and I couldn't understand anything that was going on. And I think it was just like, it was that separation of, well, I really love video games, but I'm willing to make allowances for, you know, what Anderson wanted to bring to the big screen. Because once Alice got involved, it was like, well, we're throwing everything out the window. Got it. She's not a character in the movie.
Yeah, so Mila's character is not in the video game. Right. She's invented just for the movie.
Just for the franchise, yeah. And then he just populated the film universe with, you know, Barry and Claire and, you know, and all these, you know, other characters. I just accepted it. But, you know, over time, as I've tried to do what you did, I just have no patience for it. I can't do him anymore. And to be honest, I mean, like, the Romero script was not – it was very close to the video game when I read it, like, over probably 15, 12 years ago now. But, you know, because he had the giant alligator in it. He had the plant creature. He had all those things that made Resident Evil, Resident Evil. But
you mean it was a faithful adaptation?
It was a faithful adaptation.
Like we might delve into momentarily?
Oh, yeah. It's a good segue. Yeah. Well, speaking of adaptations, I just want to talk about a quick book. Last month I talked about Adam Caesar. I had finished Video Night. And Dave Parker recommended another book.
Is this the Con one?
The Con Season.
I read this.
Con Season is incredibly interesting.
Yes.
And it is for horror fans by a horror fan because it's full of in-jokes and other sly things that Caesar wanted to throw in about conventions. But basically, it's about these two, from what I've gathered so far, it's about these two psychopaths that lure in a lot of B and C grade horror actors and actresses because they've got some plan in place, and I don't know how nasty it's going to get. So you're kind of focusing on one horror starlet who is in her 50s, who has been invited to this horror experience, the summer camp experience. It's not a convention, but the fans will be there and you're probably going to be on camera. They're going to shoot kind of like this kind of nitty gritty horror film. And so, you know, so you're kind of getting inside the head of these actors as well as the guys who are putting it on, who have also kidnapped kind of like a the best way I could describe it is like a Jim Van Beber type, and they're using him and his film skills to pull this event off. That's about as far as I've gotten so far.
It's good. It's I like this book fun. A lot.
Yeah, but it's definitely for the horror crowd, you know? You know, when you first meet these two psychopaths, they're beating the shit out of somebody, and they're like, wait a minute, you don't have Kane Hodder's representations number? We just need to get a hold of Kane Hodder, yeah. You know, and it's fun. It's a really fun book. So I'm on an Adam Caesar kick, and I'm liking it.
All right.
Yeah. Well, we were talking about adaptation. What do you want to take What We Do in the Shadows?
Yeah, so I'll talk about the two shows. I watched, I binged Santa Clarita Diet Season 3 over the past couple of nights. Wow. And then I watched What We Do in the Shadows. First episode, they've only released the first episode of What We Do in the Shadows because they're doing it as like a day and date presentation. Even though that they're pushing it to the FX app pretty quickly, it's definitely still like a weekly thing that they're doing. And it doesn't hit the app until afterwards.
I think you can buy a season pass on Amazon. That's what I was looking into.
Yeah, I think I'm going to.
Because it's like $20 and you'll get every episode as they air.
Right. The first one, so wonderful.
It's so good.
It's just really? So it wonderful. Really really oh my God, the energy vampire, I was dying. I was just dying.
Wait, so Rob, have you seen it? Rob?
I have not. No, I'm going to pull the trigger.
Okay, the reason
after this.
My pitch to you, the reason why I think it's good is because it could be in the same universe, and it's not a reboot because it's not a bunch of New Zealand vampires. It's basically these old Russian ones who are in
Long Island
or Long Island.
Yeah. What?
They live in Long Island.
They live on Staten Island. Because that's where the boat dropped them off.
Oh, that's right.
but I think that was such a smart choice by them because I didn't find myself comparing it to the movie at all. Yeah. It just felt, to be honest, like it's part of the same world, and they're over here while those other vampires could enter the world.
So they're not the same character.
Yeah. I don't think so
not
at all.
In any capacity. Okay, cool.
So yeah, they definitely live in the same universe. And you know, they retread similar funny beats in the first half, but it really takes hold and has its own voice. And there was a moment, I mean, like, I have not been in tears over a joke in a long time, but one of the vampires goes to, like, a CVS because he wants to get some
creepy paper.
So he wants to get some glitter and some, you know, fancy stuff to throw a party. And he's like, oh, creepy paper. And his familiar's like, it's crepe paper. It's crepe paper. He's like, creepy paper. And I was like, what the fuck? Why am I laughing so hard?
And he buys glitter.
And he buys glitter
to the vampire from Twilight. And I laughed out loud. Like, I guffawed.
No, mine was the energy vampire because they bring in this new type of vampire and he's an energy vampire where he just kills you with conversation. So he looks like an accountant
and he's really boring.
Works in an office and you'll see him like talking to people and he's like, so when I'm looking you know, into car washing, I like to get the full detail. Like, and it's just these monotonous conversations.
And the people just fall asleep.
And then he walks away and his eyes turn red. It's just brilliant.
But the twist is he's the only kind of vampire who can drain a vampire. Yes. So he can bore vampires to death and they're like, oh, the energy in the room is so bad. But
I gotta watch this.
But for people, for me, the end was because Becca told me, oh, it's really good, and I was like, skeptical because I love the movie so much. But you know, fans of Garth Marenghi, which is my all-time favorite anything.
Yes,
Matt Berry, who's one of the stars of Garth Marenghi, is one of the vampires. So when I saw that, I was like, oh my God! Like,
he's also so on two of my fave British shows ever, Mighty Boosh and Snuffbox.
Yeah,
he's on both
genius.
Of them, and the
female vampire is I guess a comedian, and she's fantastic. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't a female vampire in the original, so I think they're playing with things in a really fun
way. And this one, they acknowledge the video crew, which they had not done that much in the movie, but in
well,
this one, when one of the character awakens, he kind of looks around and then they go, oh, it's a film crew. Yeah. Don't mind. Like, they acknowledged it for the first time, which I thought was really cool.
I think we just spoiled all the jokes, but that's okay.
We did not touch on it.
It's still great.
It's still great. So I had a blast with that, and then I immediately started Santa Clarita Diet Season 3, and I was like, I'm just going to watch the first episode. I swear that writing the show has the smartest writing. It's just so funny. The jokes hit, they punch, they're fast, they keep coming, and yet it's got gore to it. The second season was better than the first season for me, and so far the first couple episodes I've watching of the third is on par with the second season. Mm. I know Rob was a big fan of the second
they,
season.
Yeah, they really got their footing on the show season 2. Like season 2 was like pretty flawless, and they were in a good direction, so they ended it just... I mean, I'm just so overwhelmed. Like, I saw it, like it dropped, and I'm like, a whole other season of that already, and Sabrina's about to come back, and I didn't finish that that one yet. And it's like, Jesus, I can't keep up with these shows.
No, Santa Clarita Diet and What We Do in the Shadows were both like a fresh of breath air for me, because I've spent most of the fall kind of binging these really heavy horror shows where I'm like, okay, I have to take a break before I watch any more Castle Rock or anything like that, or Haunting of Hill House, where they're just these heavy shows. I watched Santa Clarita Diet 3 episodes and What We Do on the Shadows, What We Do in the Shadows on one night, and was just like, this has just been the best night of viewing ever. And then the next night I watched Lords of the Deep, and then decided to keep going with Santa Clarita Diet because I watched Lords of the Deep. So there we go.
I'll make your life worse, Rob, for more TV. I've watched, I think, maybe two TV shows in the last 2 years because of taking on This and Pure Cinema. So I'm just movie. But I got sick and found that I didn't want to watch movies. Like, there's something in me being sick. I just didn't want to watch. Killing Eve's the best show I've seen since, like, first season of Dexter and what's the other tone that it was kind of in Breaking Bad? Like, it is. I saw that Sandra Oh won the Emmy, and I was like, I've never even heard of the show. Mm-hmm. So I binged watched 8 episodes. It's on Hulu. It's Hulu? Coming. The next season's about to come on. It is that tone. So if you love Dexter, it's first season. The tone of this movie, it's a tone of the show. It's like black comedy, super dark characters, but also like it's also kind of going into this dark thrillerish element. So it definitely has genre beats. It is so good. Like, I mean, just the character Sandra Oh plays, this incredible, she's initially a banal M6 worker. She's an American, but working for British intelligence, and she's more of a desk jockey. She shouldn't be a field operative. But then in Russia, there's this Russian hit woman who has basically got zero empathy and is just like brutal, killing anyone she wants, and no one believes a woman's capable of doing this except for Sandra Oh's character. And she kind of has to start going rogue to prove her way. And then their two worlds start to collide, and they basically become kind of obsessed by each other. So it's really about female obsession with each other, and it's just bonkers. The places it goes by the end of the 8 episodes, you're like, this is one of the best shows. Oh, and it's wow. BBC America, and that might be why initially we hadn't heard too much, but now it's going to be coming on AMC. Now it's going to be on AMC, and then the next season starts, I guess, in a couple days.
Yeah.
Wow.
Season 2. And the second season will kind of pick up right where the first left off, because it kind of leaves on a cliffhanger. It's phenomenal. Like, seriously, when I finished it, I was like, how did I not know about this thing? It's super entertaining. So put that on your extra
list. I will.
I've
been meaning to see that one anyway, so.
Yeah, I loved it. Really great thing. But I didn't really watch movies, so. But, you know, it's king time.
It's very weird for me to hear Elric go, I didn't watch movies.
It's weird for me. It's like the longest I think
not
I've ever
this one.
Being sick. Yeah, she slipped me some hard drugs before the show. I was
totally.
I was still really sick this morning.
Really?
But she gave me some sort of drug.
It's
what's it called?
Sudafed.
Yeah, I've never heard of it.
I gave him Sudafed. And then I told him it's what they make meth out of.
And ever
suddenly
since
he
I've
was
been
like,
doing great.
Why did you give this to me, Becca?
I feel so good, Becca. I need more of it.
Sudafed. If you have allergies, you know it well.
Did you get that in Appalachia? I need more of that.
Well, I mean,
where'd you get the Sudafed stuff?
CBS in Burbank.
All right. I got it.
All right. Before we dive into King, one more thing, because I think it's going to be happening when this episode airs. And I know I saw it, and Ryan got a sneak peek at a LA experience called I Like Scary Movies.
Yes.
Yes.
Which is basically a 25,000 square foot facility in LA, yep, right on Wilshire. And
it's an immersive horror installation.
Yes, an art installation, and they were still building it when I went. And basically, it's several rooms. Apparently, when it's done, you know, you pay your fee at the door, and it's going to be somewhere between 60 and 90 minutes to get through the whole thing. Hmm. And what's cool about it, you know, it's a very modern art installation, mm-hmm, in the terms of that each room is devoted to a movie, whether it be Stephen King's It or Beetlejuice or Nightmare on Elm Street. Mm-hmm. We all got photos.
Lost Boys.
But what's fascinating about it, what the artists are doing that I thought was interesting is they really have catered it, for better or worse, to the Instagram generation. Hmm. The way that each room is being lit and designed is specifically for you to take pictures in. And so you get to be a part of these kind of, you know, I mean, it's just one of those things. And yeah, it's super smart marketing, because everyone's going to want that picture and then post about it. And now more people are reading about, you know, this installation.
Yeah, this is a trend. There was a thing called the Ice Cream Factory.
Ice Cream,
yeah,
which I really wanted to do.
I did Funbox LA, which was the same thing, where it was just rooms. Like, this room has 500 pigs. Banks in it, and this room's full of flowers, and
it's a little bit what we're doing with Slashback Video,
you know,
in terms of it being an immersive experience, mm-hmm, and then setting up things around for so they're key you know, photographic experiences. Yeah.
Yeah, but I like this. It was, you know, so like in the Lost Boys room, for example, there's like, you know, there's like the David's Den in one corner. Mm-hmm. But then the other, they built kind of like the bridge, and behind it, you can kind of hang from it. So basically you and your friends can get a photo of you hanging off the bridge like in Lost Boys. Yeah. But no, I thought it was really fascinating. It's been fun to see. Obviously they want us horror people to talk about it. So we've all been going. So yeah. I went one morning and I walked in and I thought I was going alone. And, Jonah Ray and his wife were in my, crew, yeah. as was Michael Dougherty. And I was, sorry, I'm name dropping. The only reason it's funny is because I was wearing a Trick or Treat t-shirt
yeah.
and walked in and I saw Dougherty and I said, oh shit, if I knew you were going to be here, I would have wore this shirt because I feel like the nerd that showed up to the, like the concert wearing the band, but whatever. Yeah. But it was a lot of fun. And, yeah, I think it kicks off by the time this airs, right?
Yeah, it'll be it'll be in full swing.
So there's that. Okay, how about some Stephen King honor of our guests in Pet Sematary?
Okay, so we all narrowed down our top five favorites Stephen King adaptations.
Yes, and my rule, and I don't know if anyone adhered to it, but I felt like we should stay with horror since it's a horror podcast. So Stand By Me is undeniable. Shawshank Redemption is undeniably great adaptations, but they're not – they're just great movies. And so I thought it'd just be more fun if we dove into the horror stuff.
Absolutely.
Well, we also need to preface that this is our personal favorites, not – at least I did not pick the ones that I consider to be amazingly made films, like The Shining. I went with ones that I personally really responded to or just love or will watch over and over or found completely tantalizing the first time I saw them.
Rose Red at one? Jesus, Becca. Oh,
stop cheating.
You are just trying to –
Rose Red at one.
Yeah, mine were definitely like about those films that are firing on all levels in terms of hitting my pleasure centers personally and have instant rewatchability. Like I turn to these over and over and over again.
Yeah, I think that's fair. It's also like impact on when you saw them, how they impacted you. It really triggered me. I'm not kidding with this podcast I was listening to where they were ranking all the King and they could only pick seven and they had to be put in order to create the perfect list, right? And some would get left on list when they voted Shining off this list because to them, but it's a great movie, but it's not a good King adapt. Those kind of words are such fucking bullshit. A good fucking movie adaptation is a good fucking movie.
Yeah.
Forget the fucking book. Preach. Okay. Now don't
we hit a nerve with
but in general, like all the movies the five movies on my list are all basically auteurist films by these great directors
who
have boldly they've boldly taken the material to make the best movie version of that, which is exactly what you should do, whatever the writer thinks or not, because otherwise you're being a slave to a story. And I think what happens with a lot of middling King, and there is a lot of middling movies. I mean, if you look at the 50 movies, you go to any ranking system, about 40 of them are very middling. And I think, and no offense to the directors, but I think often it's because they're kind of middling directors without necessarily strong vision. Yeah. But so they're just being strong service to the book. And the book is a totally different medium. Movies and books have never been they've never always played that well together, because think how long a book is, right? Yeah. And also it's being told from the eye perspective. So I think having a very firm vision, and to a point where it might be a flaw for some people, these weird preoccupations that a director brings into that.
Yeah.
Now you're getting a fusion into a movie, and I love that. So all five of mine, well, one guy I wouldn't necessarily call an auteur, but of the five, they're all pretty, you know, strong directors.
Yeah. I was instinctual. I didn't really even think about this. I picked like five or six, and I'm like, those are the ones I still think. When people say King, they're the movies that come to my mind right away.
Yep.
So, Ryan, why don't we kick off with you? We'll do five, and we'll just do one
start with my number one?
With number five.
Number five. All right, Langoliers. Let me tell you about the length. No, I'm kidding. I'm fucking
holy shit.
Yeah, sold it for about a second.
I know. I was like, okay, you know what? It didn't like the is like attacking everything, but I was going to hear you out, dude.
No.
All right.
Number five, obvious Maximum Overdrive.
Wow.
Nice.
You could find me on the Blu-ray commentary enthusing about this marvel of cinema. No, seriously, Maximum Overdrive just like, you know, when I was a kid, the story is when I was a kid, I went to the video store. I chose this with my parents. I had the VHS in my hand. I was so stoked to see it. And my dad was like, what could go wrong? It's about a bunch of trucks and cars, you know, killing people. And I was like, exactly. We all settled in for a nice Turek family dinner. We watched the film, and then this fucking kid gets run over by a steamroller. And my mom was like, nope.
Yeah.
She turned it off, and for a good 2 years, it was that forbidden fruit that I needed to see.
That's why.
I snuck away. I saw it. And you know what? I had a good time with it. It begins with batshit crazy. A comet is going by Earth. It disrupts all the fucking machines. I mean, the movie is just so bananas. It is just pure craziness. It has no rules. It has pure violence. It's got Emilio Estevez yelling at trucks.
AC/DC music.
It's got AC/DC music. It's got one of the greatest trucks on a drawbridge sequences ever. You know, you got this like motorcycle guy going, whoa, as he falls into the water. You've got a
I haven't
water.
Seen this one since I was 10 or 12.
Oh, dude.
Like, so I, although every time you talk about it, I'm like, maybe I got to redo this
you
one.
You got a scene where a kid on a bike is going through a neighborhood, seeing the destruction, a guy getting run over by a lawnmower. You've got a dog with a remote control car in its mouth. How did that remote control car get in that dog's mouth? That means the dog would have to bend down, open its mouth, and a remote control car would have to drive into it. How did that happen? I don't know.
Cocaine's a hell of a drug.
It is amazing. I've never done cocaine, but man, if that's what I did,
wait, you're Hollywood executive. What are you not doing? What are you doing wrong?
I love the. I don't know if you've heard this theory, but that the Disney film Cars is actually the same universe as Maximum Overdrive,
like years
but
later.
Millennium later, because everything is designed for humans, but cars are sentient and there are no humans anywhere. Like the school bus has seats and a door, but who's going to sit in them because there's only cars?
What a godless movie.
Right?
I would subscribe to that theory, but at the end of Maximum Overdrive, it says that the comet took off and everybody was fine. So no.
But the machine gun truck. Huh? The machine gun truck. I love the machine gun truck.
A machine gun truck. A gun isn't even like a machine. I mean, like, well, there's machine guns, but I mean, like, it doesn't have a motor to it. I don't know. I don't know how that works.
It doesn't matter. Works in the movie.
But, you know, it's fucking great. I just love Maximum Overdrive so much. Anyways.
Should we do the P. Bromley style where if somebody names one that somebody else has higher that we wait to discuss when we get to the higher? Because we're going to have quite a bit of overlap.
Okay.
Who?
I could do that.
It's on F This Movie. Whenever they do their top 10, they go.
Don't we do that when we do our top 10?
Do we?
Yeah. What's the matter with you,
Albert? We usually talk about it on the first one. Like, if it's my number 8, we'll talk about it at my number 8, even if it's your number 6.
We've never had a pattern.
I'm confused, but let's just go.
Let's just get through this.
I think they'll save us about 30 minutes if we do it. That's what I'm saying.
Okay.
So my number 5 is the least personal one to me on the list, but that's Carrie. De Palma's Carrie. Mostly because when I was like, I think I was 10, it came on TV and it opens with, you know, girls in the shower and then a girl menstruating and I had no idea what was happening. And, you know, I was just totally drawn in by this because I did, you know, when you don't, you know, I had no one that taught me anything about life and you're just watching the story and she's such a fragile character and to turn that fragile character into the monster by the end of the movie is deeply troubling, I think, for a young person to watch. And I think there's a lot of psychological trauma that goes on in that movie between the mother, you know, mother and daughter relationship.
Yeah.
But for some reason I've gone back to that movie kind of the least. You know, I love The Flourishes. Mm-hmm. I don't watch it that often. And so of the 5, it's the one that it was hard for me to leave Salem's Lot off because that had more of a personal impact, but that was just below this one for me for 5. So I'm sure I have a feeling Carrie will come up again. I'd be surprised if
maybe.
It didn't.
Maybe.
Let's see.
Maybe.
Oh, okay, we'll see.
Becca, number 5?
Number 5. I have a feeling it's going to be polarizing, but I went with movies that I really enjoy or found fascinating. Yeah. Secret Window from 2004.
Not a bad movie.
See, exactly. It's personal level, it hit me at a really nice time. I found it to be intriguing. I really watched it.
You stole my book.
I watched it a lot, right when it first came out. I remember I went and bought a copy of it because I found it so intriguing. And now it's a device that I've seen done a number of times, but at that time I hadn't seen it done, and I really enjoyed it. So, Secret Window.
I went to the grocery store this weekend, and I went through the magazine rack, and they had like the official guide to Stephen King movies, and it was just like one of those grocery store magazines that you just tend to pick up. And they did The Best of King, and this was their number 20.
Wow.
I would have put it much higher. It gets a lot of flack. Actually, I'm not surprised they put it that low. It does get a lot of flack. Yeah. But
I was surprised it was on the list at all, yeah. To be honest.
Yeah.
I've only seen it like once, and all I remember is the DVD has a slightly alternate ending, which is 10 times better. And I was like, well, if that ending was on this movie, then I would love this movie.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
All right, Secret Window for you. Mine is one. I've only seen this movie maybe twice, maybe three times, and it's Cujo. I saw it on video when it came out, and it scared the heck out of me. And then maybe a couple years ago when a Blu-ray came out of it.
No, we watched in 16mm at Jump Cut.
I wasn't there for that, I don't think. But no, there was a Blu-ray that came out, I think, through Olive Films a few years ago, and that's when I revisited it as an adult. And this is Louis Teague, who had done a couple of interesting movies.
Alligator.
Alligator. I think he did Cat's Eye as well.
Cat's Eye.
But there's a certain sense of danger, especially to the third act in this movie and the way that it's all executed.
And the adult relationships leading up to it, the affair.
Yeah.
It's very... I think it's one of the best adaptations of his work.
And, by far.
And when I saw it again at Jump, it affected me a lot as a kid. And I think I might have said this way back when we recorded, was I was that kid. I had to jump into – there's a scene where he runs and jumps into his bed because he's so scared. I totally remember doing that every single night and then hiding under the covers because you watched horror films when you're young and got fucking freaked out. Yeah. So like there's so much in this movie I can identify with. I think it's a superb – and it's really disturbing and scary.
Yeah.
Well, imagine Lee Gambin did a great book about –
I kind of get that, yeah.
And I've been reading it in chunks.
Yeah.
But the original vision of Cujo, the film, was to go back to the book. You know, the guy who's the serial killer in Dead Zone that kills himself with the nut.
Yeah.
The scissors.
I can't remember his name, but I know.
So the whole vibe is in the book, in Cujo, I've never read the Cujo book, his spirit is haunting the little boy in his closet.
Oh, Jesus. And the whole
vibe is that the reason why Cujo is so fucking evil beyond the rabies and all this stuff is also because the spirit of the serial killer from the Dead Zone is
Frank inhabited. Dobb, I think.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's right. Which I think is just such a wacky concept.
Wow.
It would alter
far less grounded than
far less grounded. Exactly, exactly.
But also it's like one of the best dog performances. I think the best mom in all of
Dee Wallace.
I think that's her protecting her child. It's a little higher on my list, but pretty close.
Yeah, I mean, again, with minimal viewings, it still has that impression that I can. It's in my top five.
Yeah,
of faves. So Cujo for me, really Ryan.
2017, It. This is a film that quickly jumped into my top five. I've seen the film a couple times.
I can't decide until I see the next one. I feel like that will dictate the whole story.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it the first time. Well, I saw it twice in the theater and once on Blu-ray, and it's just it hits all again. It just like hits all of those things that I love about King, and I think that Muschietti did a great job visually, and I think all the kids are fantastic. Again, instantly rewatchable for me.
Okay.
No, I think it's really watchable. But I do want to know how the whole story will kind of come together on that one. But 4 was Cujo, so I don't need to – 4, it could go up to 3. It's somewhere in there. I just think Cujo is – there's something so raw about the way it looks too. And if you look at Louis Teague's other films, Louis Teague was quite a major editor as well. And so none of the other films really have this feeling. Like Alligator's funny largely, a lot of comedy. There's nothing in his work that to me would say that this guy could have pulled off this movie. And I think it's just a really emotionally kind of devastating film in the same way that the new Pet Sematary is. I think those two pair pretty well as unrelenting King adaptations.
I still have problems watching Cujo because of the animals. Like even though I know it's not
really
a dog.
Sad.
No, I know. I just I can't. It's like watching Old Yeller for me or my dog Skip, where I'm just like, I know I'm going to get upset, so I can't watch it on quite that same level. It's a wonderful film. I don't think I've seen it since I was 10.
That real villain is the bat.
Yeah.
What a dick.
But the bat was just being the bat.
All right, Becca?
Yeah. So next up at number 4 is Night Flyer, 1997.
That's actually a really good.
It's great.
It's a very good movie.
Fun. Mm-hmm. It's just fun. It's something, I mean, it feels like a noir detective thriller. It is a noir detective thriller. And it feels like a 1940s, like serial and radio play all at the same time. It's just, I have so much fun with it, but it's hyper gory. And the vampire was actually scary. And I just always had fun with this. It was one that really took me by surprise. I remember in the 90s being like, oh, this was like right after Sting had, or King had had his kind of, I'll call it not so great years, Tommyknockers. And so then this came out and I remember being kind of like, oh, I don't know about this. And it's a vampire and he has an airplane. I don't know about this a lot, but then watching it and being like, you know what? That was just fun.
It was actually Rob's interview with the director that made me revisit this one. And I think the horror sequences in this, it almost would have made my list based on the horror sequences. Mm-hmm. I think the creature is freaking rad, vampire. I think the crazy black and white Fulci flashbacks are mind-blowing. But what I just – for me, it's a little dated is the parts of the serial stuff with Miguel Ferrer and just that kind of His Girl Friday-type vibe. And it's something a little dated. Yeah, this thing to the 90s, that feels a little dated. But I think it would actually be ripe for a remake.
Because they did that same thing with I'm Madman, and I really enjoyed it.
It's a taste thing. I see why. But I do think it's a really cool movie. Mm-hmm.
I would
really
love to read Mark Pavia, the director, co-wrote with Stephen King a Night Flyer 2.
Yeah, no, I'd love to see that character.
I'd love to read that script.
Yeah, would love to see him write
that's
again.
That's cool.
Yeah, because King really loved it.
Yeah.
My number four is Christine. I mean, there's not much to say. Obviously, I love John Carpenter. I think what it was is as a kid and even now, I just really – well, Keith Gordon always reminded me of my older brother. He kind of had – like really sweet, but has a little bit of a nerdy thing going on. And just to see his transformation as an actor throughout that movie is like incredible. Like basically getting to see, just somebody completely consumed by something. And in this case, it's kind of the evil that this car, it changes his personality, changes him as a person. And again, it's like some of the sequences, the way that the bullies kind of get their come-uppings. And still to this day, I'm in awe, even though it's such a simple trick that would probably be done with CG, I'm such in awe of Christine rebuilding herself. It's like one of the greatest like 30 seconds of film.
All shot in reverse.
All shot in reverse. Looks great. And it's like, man, they just don't. Yeah.
And the part where Christine squeezes into that space to kill
some
the guy.
Scary stuff.
The loading dock, yeah.
Yeah, and it's also something that I know Carpenter, rumors were he was initially pretty unhappy with it, and it wasn't until his commentary track on one of the first DVDs with Keith Gordon that he seemed to have come around on it. And I don't know, maybe it was just, whatever was going on in his life and career at the time that he made it that he didn't feel he did as good a job as he could have.
Yeah,
this is one that climbed the ranks the highest for me because when I was a kid, I saw it and I didn't like it, and I think in my memory of it, I thought it was all set in the 50s because their style is in the 50s. And then when I rewatched it when we were doing the Carpenter thing for Pure Cinema, it's like top three now. I think it's pure genius. I think it's a great Carpenter movie. It's a great car film. It's my number three. So I really like Christine.
Okay.
We know Ryan likes Christine.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll get to that. Number three is The Shining. It's one of those films that my folks had introduced me to. And what more can you say about The Shining?
It's not that faithful, though, to the book. There's deviations.
It's, shut the fuck up.
It's fair.
You know what? It's also a thing that I didn't realize until I was in, like, high school and I started reading The Shining. And I was like, you know what? I saw The Shining, Kubrick's vision of it, and I dig it, And it's also, like, a thing that's just... I have a terrific painting of Jack Torrance hanging in my living room. I've got the Shining rug, it's like, it's something that, has obviously stuck with me, because I found it so terrifying. I think it's one of those movies where, I kind of adapted that skill that I had when I was a kid, where if something scares me, I try to understand it as much as possible. And I'll try to take that power back so it doesn't scare me anymore. And I think I have the Shining rug and I have the Jack Torrance painting is because it just touched a nerve with me once as a kid, because, obviously related to Danny, I was like a kid in peril. But as I got older, it was like, oh my God, the plight of Wendy and, poor Jack who's slowly losing his mind and just as a father, it's just a place you don't want to go to is that kind of lunacy and madness.
I also think the whole film feels like it's told from the boy's perspective. Like being a kid watching that movie for the first time when I was a kid,
yeah.
I feel like even the scenes he's not in are kind of being stylized in a sense from Danny's experience.
A little bit. I think it's, I think it's all of them.
And the moon landing.
But, all right, Shining.
Yeah, The Shining. The
Elric
Shining.
Said Christine was your three.
Christine is three, yep.
Becca, your three?
It 1990. Just because it affected me so much as a kid.
What are you laughing at,
I'm
Ryan?
Laughing because when I said It 2017, Rob gave this... and then it's like It 1990. Wonderful.
Well, I will say, like, I love...
It's very high on my list.
I love the new film so much. But it was on the 1991. My parents taped it off television because my parents used to... We had a massive bootleg collection. They had double VCR, so we copied everything. And then they would tape things off TV, and Mom would sit there and try to pause the commercials out, and it was a whole thing they had going on. So we had a videotape of It, and I watched it over and over. My favorite scene was the Chinese restaurant, because of all the weird little creatures that come to life and the weird little fortune cookie claw thing that's running across the table. I watched that movie over and over, and I was like 11 at the time, and it affected me because it was about kids my age. There was no rationale. And I'd watched a lot of horror films by that point, like probably more than I should have. But whereas I could rationalize zombies because you shoot them in the head, or vampires, they see daylight. There was no rational understanding of what it was, why it looked like a fucking clown, what it was doing, what it was trying to get. Like, it was like watching Phantasm for me, where I was like, I have no understanding or frame of reference for anything that's going on. And it wrecked me when I was a kid, but in that I kept watching it over and over. So it was definitely a big impact for me as a kid.
It's my number two. And so I'll just chime in really quickly now about it. And the reason is this exactly what you said. I taped it off TV, and 1990 was kind of, I think, the peak of my King fandom. Like, I was just so obsessed with everything he was doing. But, you know, it's interesting. Like, I like the 2017 movie, and I enjoy it more the more distance I have from it and go back and revisit it. I don't think it's a faithful adaptation. Maybe in spirit it is, but it's not faithful. The original one's more faithful to me, and I love everything about it. I used to watch it every day when I'd come home from school because the irony is we were the age of the kids when that one came out, and now that's why I can't wait to see It Chapter 2, because now we're the age of them as adults.
Yeah.
And so I wonder if that will resonate differently for me because now we're caught up to them. But yeah, I mean, you just can't top Tim Curry's performance, and I love all those kids. Like, it's just a terrific movie. Yeah, and one of my favorites. So,
yeah.
But my number three is Misery, and again, it's also 1990, and it was like this was the point where I started reading King's books, so I remember reading Misery, and it wasn't too far. This is when they were getting really close. Like, Pet Sematary had come out around the time, maybe a year or two after the book. Mm-hmm. Misery was pretty close to when it came out. And I remember buying The Dark Half as soon as it came out. And then the movie was like a year or two later. So this was a period where King was at his peak. I was reading the stuff. I was seeing it. But really, Misery, I mean, I loved it when it came out. But what amazes me about this movie and is every time I revisit it, which is every couple of years, it is flawless. I mean, there's a reason Kathy Bates won the Oscar for it. James Caan is amazing. And just the simplicity of this concept of being, you know, trapped with your number one fan who has all this control over your well-being. You literally have no options outside of, you know, succumbing to this woman that's taking care of you. So it's just, if you haven't seen it in a while, just, you should break it out again. It's just excellent. Really excellent.
It begs the question why Rob Reiner doesn't direct more movies in the last like 10, 15 years. Cause he's such a great director.
Yeah.
You know, people never think of him that way, I think.
Yeah. So yeah, that was my three. Number two, Ryan.
My number two is Christine.
Right.
I reach for this many, many times, and the reasons are myriad. You know, one, John Carpenter. Two, I just love the look of the film. Three, it's just a King story that I just gravitate to, probably because, you know, when I saw it, I was a teenager. But it just, you know, I love this. Like you said, you know, I love this relationship between the two boys. And it's like watching one spiral out of control, you know, it's just like a kind of a great allegory for addiction, you know, and you can't stop it. You try as hard as you can. And seeing Arnie's descent into madness and letting the supernatural force take over. And again, you know, great, King, classic King villains, and great kills. It's just one of those, and I think it's just the overall atmosphere too, because it goes seasonal, which is, you know, it starts at the beginning of the school year, and then there's Thanksgiving. But I just love the vibe of it, the kind of New England vibe to it.
Number two for me is Cronenberg's Dead Zone, which I just found to be just one of the most one of the best mood pieces I've ever seen. I think it creates like such a flawless sense of tone from start to finish of what dread should feel like, and it's also a great emotional story between the couple, you know, and such a sad story that if you get this power, that it's going to ultimately, you know, ruin his life because he's it's going to kind of change the direction everything heads in for. And Walken's incredible in it. I remember reading something that Walken has a real issue with guns in general. He does not like guns at all, and every time he's meant to have the power, Cronenberg would shoot a gun to create that jolt that he does, and it's a very real visceral reaction. But I just think it goes to some dark places that I just are unforgettable. When you watch that when you're young, like we were referencing with the scissors, with Tom Skerritt and stuff, there's just stuff in this that's so grim, but it also it's just so interesting. And it's funny that, you know, when Trump was elected, then suddenly everyone's reposting it. These movies that are eternally timely because humans are dumb and we keep repeating the same things every 20 years, the same issues. But I think this movie, you know, again, shows how great a director Cronenberg can be if with the right material. I think, you know, I felt the same about Eastern Promises when I saw that. I was like, right. Oh, damn, this guy can direct a movie, you know. Yeah. Sometimes I think, you know, some directors might be better just with great material, not just writing their own work, even though his early career is so fantastic too. But I think The Dead Zone is a fantastic movie.
Mm-hmm.
Becca, number four.
No, number two. The Mist, 2007.
Oh, wow.
In black and white or color?
I've seen it both. I definitely have to say I love them both. Okay. Like, I will watch it either way. This is one, I remember seeing this at a press screening in New York City while I was living there. And I remember that we watched it in color in the theater, and then I didn't see it on black and white until like the DVD came out. But just, I loved this movie. Like it was exactly, having read the story that it's based off of, it was exactly what I wanted it to be. It still had all the allegories. It still had amazing creature effects. Like, I just loved it.
Yeah. I haven't seen it in a while. I got to revisit it, but I want to watch the black and white one because the CG,
it made such a big difference.
It does, yeah.
The black and white, it made a huge difference. It felt like an old 50s monster movie, was so cool.
It feels like a Twilight Zone then. It definitely changed it. I mean, like, I really enjoyed it in color, but the 1950s definitely kind of, or the black and white definitely kind of rerouted. You could see what the intention was.
And the paranoia of 50s films like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, both black and white. I thought it was quite a big difference, I've got to say. Even though I liked it in color in the theater, watching it in black and white, I was surprised it could have that big an impact of shift.
Yeah, and I just wonder if it, like, upon rewatching it, if the ending has just as much impact, knowing what's coming. Because I remember the first time I saw that film, and I was crazy. Just like, you can hear a pin drop.
Oh, my God. It was shocking.
Because everybody, I mean, it was
kind of like Hereditary, because I remember when that ended, it was a similar kind of vibe in the room. It's a similar kind of thing.
Pretty intense. Well, my number two is It, so I'll just do my number one, which is The Dead Zone. And I know Elric just talked about it, but I've said it before and I'll say it again. It's my favorite King. It's my favorite Christopher Walken performance, and it's my favorite Cronenberg movie. Mm. I think it's the movie that allowed Cronenberg to do The Fly, meaning like –
prove it to a studio that he can do it. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I feel like it's the perfect primer because he's not known for love stories.
Yeah.
And I think that at the heart of Dead Zone, it's a really great love story that paved the way for an even better one in The Fly. Mm. And it's just, I don't know, it's just one of those, again, like you said, it's kind of timeless. It's crazy how timeless that movie is. And also, I mean, if you're into... Right now, it's like what's popular is Marvel movies and things like that. This is a, in terms of adaptation, this is a perfect three-act structure of a superhero. It's like he gets his power in the first act. Yeah. The second, he denies it and doesn't want to be the superhero until he gets involved and saves somebody. And then three is accepting your destiny and what you have to do. And I've always been, you know, as a comic book fan, that's the thing that I always kind of latched onto. So I love it. And actually, I want to revisit the TV show with Anthony Michael Hall. It was actually pretty darn good. I went and bought all of them at Amoeba. It cost me like $25, but I think they just reissued it as like a complete series on DVD. It ended abruptly, but there was still some great stuff in there. So I love The Dead Zone. That's my number one.
Yeah.
My number one is Graveyard Shift. So
wow.
The reason why
is the because, rat one.
No, it's April 1st, guys.
not to our listeners.
Giant rats.
They all just hit stop.
You if you had said mangler, I would have seen through.
Yeah,
I would have
been like, you're done.
No, number one is Creepshow.
Oh. Nice.
Oh, yeah. Wait. Is that an adaptation of King?
Yes. He wrote them all. He wrote the script.
Yeah, he wrote the script.
Oh, okay. I thought it had to exist.
See,
as
I wouldn't have considered
first.
It part of his mythos as well.
I left Creepshow would definitely have been on mine.
That would have hovered around five on mine.
Creepshow is my number one. It distills everything I love about King. It's got the really warped scenarios. It's got outrageous characters. You can throw in Romero's vision, Harrison's soundtrack,
Savini's
Megan. It's got meteor shit. And it's just pure macabre joy to me. I mean, like it's what's great about it is it's not one King movie. It's a bunch of little mini King movies. And you know what? The more the merrier. In terms of film, you know, King adaptations or King films, that I just throw on, Creepshow is always my number one.
Nice. Elric?
Thinner. Number one.
I know what your number one is.
I see your bullshit.
I'm wearing a T-shirt, so I led with this. It's kind of a no-brainer, but I think The Shining's one of the greatest movies ever made, beyond just horror films, beyond adaptations. I think it works on so many different levels. Forget all the crazy theories, which is fun to read into it, but it's also just an utterly mesmerizing piece of cinema. And then, like what I was saying with the kid, I saw it at 8. And it, changed my life, unconsciously, how I want, what I wanted to do and think about. But I do think it's because of the kid. I think you're about the same age as this boy who is seeing, the trouble in his parents' marriage. He's in this isolated place and he's trying to understand it. And so The Shining and whatever these powers are, I don't know how much any of that's real. Of course, they treat it like it's real, but also could just be this coping mechanism of a kid trying to understand what all this means, But the way certain scenes are shown from his perspective and rooting you physically with him going through the hotel, I think that's some of the greatest cinema, just placing you as he discovers the twins. Versus just having the twins and him in the scene. He really spent some time with the boy cycling, so you're used to being in that perspective, So I could talk about Shining all day, but I think it's,
Well, that was the thing. My takeaway when I was a kid is you felt like you lived there.
Mm-hmm.
You felt like you were in that experience.
Yeah.
When you're looking at the grand ballroom to the lobby, when you go to, they're kind of like living quarters.
Yeah.
It's just you're getting this it's just like the hotel itself is just such a character. And by the time you're done and you're outside, you're almost like shell-shocked because you're outside. I don't know. It's just like it always exhausted me made me feel so claustrophobic being in there.
It's also the most playful Kubrick film. He's a perfectionist, right? And he's always dealing with very weighty, serious subjects. In this, it feels like he's getting to play a bit more. He still has, he still has all the apparatus he wants, but he's able to just kind of let go of the story. That's, I think, why people want to believe it's about deeper things, because they can't believe he would just make this horror movie. But I think it's mostly just that horror film.
Yeah.
But anyway, I think it's brilliant.
What's your number one, Becca?
Well, I feel like Elric should have gone last because I do have to say that I feel like The Shining is the best made out of all of the King films.
Which Shining? Which version? No, because it's your list. I didn't know.
Are you fucking kidding me? No, I do.
You could have picked a wild card right here.
I am going to pull in a wild card for my number one, which is why I feel like you should have gone last, because I feel weird ending the show on 1408.
That's a good one to have.
I love 1408.
It's cool.
No, I know. But I mean, I'm saying 1408 is by far my number one, my personal favorite number one King film. But that said, if I'm like, we have to end on like this massive masterpiece note, it's The Shining. I fucking love 1408. I was not expecting this when I saw 1408 in the theater in 2007. I want to say, 2007. I wrote it down. I saw it in New York and it was a packed house. I had not read the book before. I had no idea what it was based off of. I was just like, oh, John Cusack's in something. This is going to be fun. And I went to see it and the audience felt it. Like, it's been, I don't get scared in theaters that much just because this is what we do all the time. And I was scared in that movie. Like, there was actually moments in that when I was like, this is really fucked up shit. Like, I was
I got to see it again, because I just remember it being kind of a playful, haunted
That's
hotel.
What I always
I don't remember any...
Playful. It was...
And gags.
Some
I remember
heavy
it being big
moments.
Gags. Really? Okay,
there's definitely some heavy moments.
I definitely liked it. Maybe I'll rewatch. Who? It's like a European director or something? I do remember that.
Michael Hafstrom.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I think you're going to convince me to give it a rewatch. I definitely
remember
liked it.
Having some – I was definitely like – there were some really unsettling moments in it. And I also remember the ending being particularly upsetting for me, because then you find out kind of his backstory, which just across the board was like really upsetting. But yeah. And up to that point, it was fun. So it was just – it was a fun ride with some choice upsetting moments. And it left an impact. And I hadn't read the story going in, so I was just seeing the film. And then later I doubled back and read the story. And was like, you know what? I still love it. Oh. So, yeah.
I couldn't have picked your list for $1 million. I could not have picked those five movies in one row.
Yeah. Oh, but they're all me.
But that's par for the course.
Well, and this is all in celebration of Pet Sematary.
Yeah.
Got the directors coming on right now. So another word from our sponsor, and we'll be right back.
This week's episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by the following advertisers. Get ready to delve deep into a weird world of essential cult entertainment only on Full Moon's Amazon channel. Classic Full Moon and Empire Pictures faves like Castle Freak, Puppet Master, Subspecies, Necropolis, Intruder, Head of the Family, Evil Bong, The Ginger Dead Man, Laser Blast, The Pit and the Pendulum, and Lurking Fear. All of these share space with a wild library of cult creepers from the legendary Blue Underground and Something Weird video labels, the Andy Sedaris and Jess Franco collections, the Eurocine archives, Trailers from Hell, and much, much more. It's an unlimited onslaught of awesome right at your fingertips 24/7. New uncut movies are added every week, and all titles are available in the highest definition available. So get yourself over to Amazon and subscribe to Full Moon today for only $6.99 per month. Your glaze balls will never be the same again. Trust us.
Diabolik DVD is Shockwave's number one spot for demented discs from all over the world. You can check them out online at www.diabolikdvd.com. That's spelled DIABOLIKDVD.com. They're the number one source for horror, cult, and strange films from around the world. If you are looking for rare, unique, and strange films, then you need to head over to Diabolik DVD. Right now at Diabolik, they have all the AGFA titles, including Blood Lake, Lady Street Fighter, and Ninja Zombie. They also have all of the Seven releases, including Death Warmed Up and Escape from a Woman's Prison, and also all the latest from Scream Factory, including The Brain, Seven Golden Vampires, When a Stranger Calls Back, The Chosen, and Superstition. For all of your horror and cult cinema needs, head on over to www.diabolikdvd.com or find them on Facebook.
Fangoria turns 40 this year, and Issue 3 is out to subscribers now. It's 100 pages of exclusive, carefully curated horror content honoring horror's past, present, and future. Fangoria is also getting into music. Holly Doom is a collection of synthwave scores from artists like John Carpenter, Power Glove, Gunship, and more. Holly Doom is available now wherever you download music. Fango's bookline continues. Joining Preston Fassel's Our Lady of the Inferno is Max Booth III's Carnivorous Lunar Activities. It's a bloody romp about the dilemma of what to do when you discover your childhood BFF is a werewolf. Relatable. Carnivorous Lunar Activities is available for pre-order now. Head to Fangoria.com to learn more and subscribe. $60 gets you a year subscription and saves you about $20 off the cover price. So head to Fangoria.com.
The Shockwaves team is heading to Texas Frightmare Weekend, presented by Arrow Video. The event is the Southwest Premier Horror Convention, now in its 14th year. Bruce Campbell, Tim Curry, Robert Englund, Lee Majors, Meatloaf, Joe Bob Briggs, and many, many more, all expected to appear. I expect film celebrations for Halloween, Reanimator, A Nightmare on Elm Street, The Rocky Horror Picture Show, and Evil Dead. Texas Frightmare Weekend takes place May 3rd to the 5th at the Hyatt Regency at the DFW Airport. For more info, visit TexasFrightmareWeekend.com.
All right, this week we have a very special Stephen King adaptation hitting wide release from Paramount Pictures. It's called Pet Sematary. Now, we've just spent the last a good chunk of the show talking about our favorite Stephen King adaptations. So let's get into the interview section of the show. Let's welcome Dennis Windmeyer and Kevin Kolsch, directors of The New Pet Sematary.
Woo,
fellas.
Hello. Welcome back.
Welcome back.
Well, actually not back.
That's
We've
true.
We've only been on Killer POV.
You guys have never been on Shockwaves.
But you were on
Killer Point of Views.
Two. You guys, for Starry Eyes, and then they came on for Zulawski.
But you guys probably would have been on Shockwaves if you had made a movie between these two.
Well, let's give a shout out to.
Hey, we're all friends. Just
exactly. Yeah, we're all friends here. I met Dennis and Kevin at South by Southwest when their terrific indie feature, Starry Eyes, made its debut. And I remember sitting at some bar in Austin, and I was supposed to interview you guys. I interviewed you. It became less of an interview and more of just like a shooting the shit, talking about horror and Stallone and a lot of other things. Alex Esso was there. And then at the end of it, I think it was like, let's just all be friends.
Yeah.
And we're like, yeah, cool.
Yeah.
But anyways.
I'm pretty sure Dennis came to one of the Blumhouse Halloween parties as Cobra, if I'm not mistaken.
You are Cobra.
Is this true?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. My wife is Stallone. Brigitte Nielsen.
And that's why we're friends.
Yes. Well, and it was a match made in heaven.
Well, guys, I mean, yeah.
Oh, no, I was going to say, it's funny that you say that, though, because like most artists that they go, oh, I'm always trying to get back to my roots. I'm trying to get back to that interview roots.
You know? I know. All I've been doing is just trying to get a fulfilling interview from you guys because the last time I think I got about 10 minutes of content. So
we'll try our best.
Here we go.
Let's do this.
This is it.
Well, let's talk about post Starry Eyes, Dennis and Kevin.
Okay.
Were you guys, before Pet Sematary and after Starry Eyes, what were you guys developing? What were you guys working on?
Well, to answer Elric's earlier dig, it takes a long time.
You guys did a Scream TV show during
that
time. Yeah, exactly.
Some are not aired yet. Yeah,
I know. God damn.
Not a movie.
That's right.
Holiday. And they did Holidays. That is a movie.
That's an anthology segment of
it. You guys are answering their question, but yes, that's what they did.
Look, here's what happens, and this is actually like a good lesson we learned, is that you get into like development territory on projects. Like you get an agent and you sit down with the agent. And the first thing they always say to you is, "All right, so what do you want to do?" You know, and you talk about, "Oh, we're writer directors. We have a lot of screenplays, so we definitely want to continue doing that." Okay, but would you guys do ODAs, like you know, official directing assignments? Would you read scripts? Yeah, sure. Okay, and then that kind of becomes a thing. Everywhere you go, every general pitch meeting you have. The way the meeting goes is 20% of it is you talking about your own stuff, and the other 80 is them saying, "Well, here's what we got," you know. And so they pitch you on things that they're working on, and you want to be agreeable and you want to fix things. You have this tendency to want to be like, "Ooh, I know how to make their movie better." So very quickly we realized that we were good in the room and we were good at kind of coming on board other studio horror films and rewriting them. So those 3 or 4 years, basically, we were attached to three properties at three different studios.
Now, would you say the South by Southwest experience helped you guys? I mean, did it – obviously, your film's getting exposure, but, you know, how did that help you get in front of more faces that go on the water bottle tour?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, we got our manager out of South by.
There you go.
The movie there. That's where we got our manager. He's the one who took us on our first water bottle tour, which included the agencies. We got our agent through that. Mm-hmm. We got our lawyers through that. So, yeah, everything came out of that South by.
That's
screen.
Great.
Yeah. And they dug, you know, people seem to like really dig that film, you know, like it's one of those movies that's kind of, you know, is a little subversive. And so we thought like going on these meetings with like Hollywood execs and stuff, they would be like, "Oh, are you making fun of us?" You know, but they all kind of got the satire of it and like dug that and liked it. So, you know, it was like a good conversation to have that then always led to like other interesting things, you know.
And quite a lot got close of those two, right? Because I remember for a while, Mama 2 was like a big title that you guys were attached to.
Ironically, that didn't get as close as the other two, though.
You know?
That was probably the sexier title out of the three. But
yeah, I mean, all of them we did rewrites on. We did passes on the scripts, multiple passes to where like we were developing it. But, you know, I think The Bringing was the closest one. We had, you know, we had a star attached.
Michael Pena was attached. You know?
Wow.
I was shifting my wedding dates to be like, "Oh, I'm making this movie in 2017. And I was like, and then like in the 11th hour, it fell through. We were shocked. We were waiting for like a contract to come through. And it fell through. We were like, "Enough of this."
And instead, you moved your wedding date. And then we had a different conflict.
Scream. Yeah. I was on a flight to Atlanta the day after I got married to go back to continue directing Scream. So, yeah, that's the life, you know. But
And how do you think the television experience helped inform the making of your next feature? Were there takeaways from working in TV?
My favorite thing about working in TV that was funny was coming off an indie film, the second that we first got to Scream, I remember like planning shots with Dennis, and I was going like, and you're talking with the DP, and you're going like, he's like, what do you think of this shot? And you're like, I was thinking maybe Steadicam, like, you know, like, because I'm used to like an indie film where they're like, put all your Steadicam shots on the same day because you can only rent it for one day.
You get one day of Steady, that's all you get. You get a Dolly day too.
And then like the DP be like, all right, grab the Steadicam off the truck. And you're like, oh, there's one on the truck. There's one always on the truck. And you know, like, and you're like, how about a crane? And they're like, yep, that's on the other truck. You know, there's a B unit that builds the crane while you're shooting. So when we get to that shot, which is ready to go, and like, and it's just kind of like,
efficiency is great.
Yeah. So, that's one of the things we took away, that when we were going to Pet Sematary, we were like, we're going to do anything. We're going to do all the cool shots we want.
Just working with, Scream didn't have the biggest budget, but like, you know, Starry Eyes was like $300,000. It was really, 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 you know, very, you know, very cheap. And Scream was about $3 million. So like that was pretty, or 1.5, I think.
Is that
which is still
episode?
Very low budget per episode. Yeah. But that's kind of common, you know, Ryan, you could answer that too. It's kind of common, you know, maybe kind of on the low end. But to us, it was like going from that to that was bigger crews, like Kevin's saying, better equipment, you know, really good efficiency.
Yeah, and the biggest thing was, I keep telling people, is the soda, you know, because like on
you talked about this when you came in to talk to my class.
I talked about it at UC. You'll hear it on all the other podcasts. On like day two on Starry Eyes, we were on to like America's Choice or Kroger soda, and you're like, and then you look at like, you know, on Pet Sematary, and it's like, there's midday snacks, there's like, you know, here comes the caviars, you know.
Lobster
dinners every night.
They're like, they're serving lunch early. They're like, this isn't lunch, this is the midday snack. I'm like, what the hell is the midday snack?
Wow.
All right. And you're full by the time you get to lunch. That's the irony. That's the only difference.
Well, you guys create a process.
You guys jumped on to Scream season 2.
Yeah,
when
we did
your first episode was
episode 10, season 2.
And yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about that, because what's interesting about TV is that the director is the changing variable. So it's usually the same crew, the same cast, and like you're kind of just coming in and out.
It's a machine.
But what I liked about your episode is stylistically, and I'm not just saying this, like I knew it was you guys right away. There was a lot, because yours took place kind of in a coffin
contained,
a lot of it. And so, you know, how much freedom is there when you're going in for whatever it is, just a couple days to put your own style into an episode? It seems like they were open to that, at least on the Scream experience.
Yeah.
We got kind of lucky.
Yeah, and they're open to it. But we did get lucky with that script, because, you know, in television, there's the writer is king, you know, or the showrunner, and the scripts already exist. So it's just kind of like, you know, when we did Scream season 3, we did episode 1 and episode 6, which is a lot more set up. You know, you have to introduce all the characters in episode 1. In episode 6, you have to wrap up, because it was the final episode, you have to wrap up the arcs and you wrap up the plot and say, this is why this happened and that's why that happened. So those had a lot more talking. So there was less, you know, room to do those scenes. So it's just kind of like what you get. But like, as long as but with the episode that we got, it was, I think they were pretty open to it. I think there was only like a few things in our style that they wanted to remove, and apparently Bob Weinstein told MTV that it was staying in, you know, a few of these things, but like
the execs really liked the episode, so they fought for it, and we got lucky in that it was kind of like a standalone episode, you know, that didn't have to like talk about all the relationships and the ongoing things. It kind of just like paused into this lateral episode, and so we were like, ooh, we could be really cinematic here and do things and try things, and they'll kind of fit because this episode kind of exists on its own a little bit. So that was, you know, that was great getting to do that.
Did you guys know who the killer was in season 2? Because that's been my favorite thing about talking to those Scream directors is nobody really knows.
We didn't know.
So you're like, how do I direct this cast if I don't know?
I still don't know.
Haven't finished it yet? Well, it's on Netflix.
I finished. I forgot, though. I don't know. Yeah, but we didn't. They're pretty secretive about that on TV.
And before we delve into Pet Sematary, I do want to talk about holidays, because your segment – I mean, you know, anthologies are always an interesting mixed bag because they're going to cater to different people's tastes. But, you know, yours was Valentine's Day, and it's one of the strongest, and it's the opening one. So I think that says a lot when you're like, this is the one that has to kick off the movie.
And it was our fourth one too. Yeah. We always joke around that we wrote so many that we could have our own.
I remember being on a call with you guys about – sorry, Dennis and Kevin, you're not getting this holiday.
Yeah, they're like, Kevin Smith wants to do Halloween. We're like, oh, we had a good idea. That it was like, who wanted to do Christmas? And then we had New Year's – and then we wrote New Year's Day.
That's right.
Or New Year's Eve with Adam Egypt Mortimer doing it.
That's
then they were like, how about – Valentine's Day. We were like, by now, okay, well, you took everything else from us.
I remember that call, Ryan. You were like, I think you guys would be really good at Valentine's Day. I thought we were really good at Halloween, Christmas, and
in terms of our participation, it was like really early on in my time here at Blumhouse, and we had gotten involved in some way. We were going to spearhead a bunch of the shorts, and it was like the toughest thing was like, you know Dennis and Kevin, right? And I'm like, yeah, they're buddies. And they're like, all right, you're going to make a phone call.
You make the call.
You tell them.
I mean, what other holiday would work great for them? And I was like, oh, Valentine's Day. Like, I mean, like, what about Halloween?
Arbor Day? Day. But
you guys stepped up.
And we got inspired by it. We said, okay, we can make this work. You know, this is a good problem to have. Yeah. And we had a lot of fun with that. Again, we got to like do stylish things and kind of, you know, just kind of make a little standalone thing, which is always fun to do. And it keeps you flexing those mental muscles about, like, every time we approach a short or some things that we could do in TV, you always look at it as an excuse to get better at a certain craft, you know? Be like, all right, we're going to do a lot of underwater stuff here, you know, or we're going to work with color here, or all Steadicam, or, you know, work with cranes. So by the time we got to Pet Sematary, those small little experiences that weren't features, Elric, helped us get to our next. Helped us get to our next.
Keeping
feature,
you honest, you know? Then.
Yeah,
and there's a reason why we put Elric all the way to the end.
I'm the only one who's going to probe the truth here.
In my class, you talked about because they came in and talked to my class at USC, so I know some of the backstories already. But I'm gonna probe for the good ones here. So you talked about how that you had to go through all these interviews with like the whole cavalcade of people involved in the movie. Could you talk a little bit about like your first call, you know, asking about the project to like actually being on set? Because that seems like a much harder process. Yeah, that seems like from listening to you talk,
had to do in our lives.
Yeah, it seems like getting from point A to cameras rolling was harder than actually shooting.
We've been on this for about a year and a half now. I mean, like the project we had heard about like years ago when it had another director attached and had been in development at Paramount for like 10 years, you know, that it comes out and suddenly everyone's like blowing the dust off their Stephen King properties, like, oh, let's go make this. But Pet Sematary was always it always felt like one for us and one for them. It felt like a movie we'd want to make even at an indie level. And we're like, wow, this is so not a studio film. I can't believe they're going to make this. And they only made it the first time because there was a writer's strike and they already had the script and they couldn't take on new scripts at that point. And it was a producer, an executive at Paramount was really pushing that. And they very reluctantly made that movie. So like, we don't want to make a movie about a kid getting hit by a truck. And I think the reason why they made it this time was because it proved, you know, yet Stephen King is back. You know, and they looked at this and they said, all right, you know, we're okay taking chances on a film like this, and it's got such a great pedigree, you know. But so we read the script, the newer version of the script, in like August, I think, 2017.
I don't remember. I looked it up recently.
Yeah,
to see the email, but I can't remember what it was.
Yeah, something like that. And then so first we went in. This is the way it works. First you go and you meet a producer, and this is at Lorenzo Di Bonaventura's company. Then you meet her boss, you know. Then you meet their boss, and so on and so forth. And so by the time we were getting towards the end of it, we felt like we had met everyone at Paramount. But we hadn't met Lorenzo yet. And Lorenzo was the big producer on it. And so we were getting ready to get on an airplane to fly to Atlanta for more Scream stuff. And we were going to meet the future head of the studio, Paramount. He was a producer at that point, and he was doing First Man. So he was in Atlanta already. And they were like, when you're there working, you have to have dinner with him, and you have to meet him as well. And he wasn't even working at Paramount yet. But we couldn't meet him until we met Lorenzo, you know? So the way it worked was I was getting a haircut. Kevin, you were seeing Mother, right? Yeah. And so all of a sudden I get a phone call from our reps, and they're like, you got to meet Lorenzo right now. And it's like rush hour on like a Thursday. And he's in Brentwood, and I'm in like Los Feliz on Vermont. And they're like, you got to go there right now. He's watching Starry Eyes right now in his living room. Like, you got to drive over there and, like, you know, go meet the guy, you know, and he's got to give you the pass or else you're not moving on. So I immediately call Kevin, and I'm like, God damn, he's in the movie theater. He's not picking up. I'm like, so you take over here.
And then what happened there was it was the trailers. It didn't start yet. And then my phone's on Do Not Disturb, which you should all do in the movie theater. And then my wife checks her phone because we're still like in the commercials and trailers. She goes, Dennis is calling me. Why is Dennis calling me? And then like I take out my phone and I look and I've got like all these missed calls from our reps and stuff. And like, and I was like, oh, something must be going on. Let me get up and call him back. And as I'm getting up to go call him back, and this is what I was saying the other day. It was my like David Lynch moment here, like David Lynch movie moment. I'm going out into the lobby and I see these two guys coming in that work at the theater. They got the suits on. They got those little lights where they're looking down the rows in the theater. And I was like, what's going on? Like, So I go out into the lobby and I see them like turning around because they see me, and they come out into the lobby and I'm standing there and they go, "Are you Kevin?" Right? And I go,
Your mother's looking for you.
And I go, "Yeah." And no, they go like this. This is dead serious. This is how they wear it. They go, "Are you Kevin?" I go, "Yeah." And they go, "John says, check your phone." Right? And I check my phone, and John's our manager's assistant, and I look and I see all the calls. I go, "Oh, yes, thank you." You know, he did call. Yeah. And
that was nerve-wracking. And we were like, "Oh, it'll be a kiss-throwing meeting. Don't worry, you're fine." You know, and we drive all the way out to Brentwood. It takes like an hour and a half. We get there, and like we're in like this expensive, rich neighborhood, and we're meeting like Lorenzo Di Bonaventura. He like ran Warner Brothers for 7 years. Go look at the guy's resume. He's like a legend. And so he's like, I think he was in his pajamas or something, and like he answers the door, and like we sit on his couch. He gets us like a beer, and he's like, "I just watched your movie, Starry Eyes." We're like, "Oh my god, this is like the worst case scenario." Like, he just watched it. Like, what if he didn't like it? We have to just get in the car and leave. And he luckily, he did like it. And then it was like, he's a smart dude. So it was like a really tough meeting. Like, he had us on the ropes where he was like, he didn't buy certain things in the story. He was really questioning things about Judd and his decisions, and why would he take them there if he already knew that things came back evil. And so it was like, it was one of those nights where you really have to dig deep and be like, all right, here we go. We have to really sell this movie to this guy or else we're done, you know? And it went well, and then we were on an airplane the next morning, and before the flight took off, we get like an email from him. He's like, "You're the guys. I'm telling everyone at Paramount, they got to make this movie with you guys. Good luck. Go kick butt." Then we got to Atlanta, that we met Wick that night, Wick Gottfried, amazing. Mm-hmm. He's now running Paramount. Had dinner with him, and we weren't sure how that went. So it was always like you were never sure, you know? Then it was like 4 days of like not knowing, and like every time our reps would call about something else, we'd be like, "We don't care. What's going on with this?" And then we finally got it, I think, like a few days before Halloween, and it was just like, oh, we could collapse now, you know?
Yeah. And then we got it, and I told Paramount, I said, "You guys owe me a screening of Mother," because that's a Paramount.
They never made up for it. They never did. So, yeah.
Well, I want to delve into how you even approach doing this, because obviously you guys grew up huge Stephen King fans. I assume you saw and loved the original movie.
Yes.
And
I almost wore the
shirt probably
tonight.
The book. What was that?
I almost wore the original shirt tonight.
So what's and at some point, audience, we are going to go into deep spoilers, so we'll warn you right before we delve in, but we might not have to right away.
Yeah.
But what was the starting point? Because you said they've been developing it for a while. Mm-hmm. I know. I think like Alex Aja was going to do it for quite a while. Mm-hmm. So what's the starting point for you? What did they give you to start with, and how, you know, what, where did you begin?
Well, the project's been in development for years, like Dennis was saying. They've tried to redo this movie numerous times, but you know, it took really like it kind of regenerating that kind of Stephen King renaissance that got this movie going. So when we came in, there was a script that they had, but it had been like, I don't know, it had been overdeveloped probably for some time, and it kind of departed too much from the source material for our taste. You know, we kind of felt like if we do something, we're good with changes, like, and some of the things we'll talk about later when we get into the spoiler area, if we talk about changes. Some of the changes, we were like, oh, that's a good change that makes sense, but stays true to the essence of Stephen King's book. But when you're doing an adaptation, that's what we always want to do. We want to at least stay true to the essence or the spirit. But there was a lot of things in the script that we felt were just going too far in a different direction to where, like, fans might just disown this movie and say this isn't Pet Sematary. So our take was, really, like, our take was just pulling it back closer to the book, saying, hey, let's keep some of these cool new things that you did in here, but let's put back in some of the iconic characters that aren't in here, and let's just kind of put the Stephen King, the essence of Pet Sematary, back into this.
Yeah. So you went back and reread the book, but did you bother with the movie? Because sometimes it's I don't want to see it again.
We did. And we read Stephen King's original script, like earlier drafts of the movie, where there was like giant Wendigo footprints that Judd could like stand in.
Yeah.
He's blasting Huey Lewis while they go bury the cat on his headphones.
Wow.
The way that and that's the thing. If people talk about like, oh, why'd you change this? Why'd you change that? Stephen King in his own script has Judd wearing Bruce Springsteen t-shirts. And in that scene where they go to bury the cat, which is the walking through the woods, it's scored to Huey Lewis in the News coming out of Judd's headphones.
Oh my gosh, which song? Is it Hip to Be Square?
No,
it should be.
I think it's some, I
it was
don't
a deep track.
Like
a,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a deep track.
Well, I remember, an earlier incarnation, and I'm glad you guys changed this, is there was no Zelda and very, very little Judd, which was very interesting.
Yeah, and we put all that stuff.
Odd choices.
You know what it was, too? Because here's what it was. A lot of their concerns about the script were answered by going back closer to the novel. So, for instance, like, we want to do more with Rachel. She needs a little more meat on the bones. We want to beef that character up. And we're like, well, that's what Zelda does. Like, Rachel's arc is defined by her backstory with her sister and the guilt she has over what happened to the sister. So if you want her to be more substantive in this story, you have to put Zelda in. That's all tied to her character.
Backstory.
Don't say meat on your bones and Zelda all at the same time.
I went the backstory route.
Or backstory.
Yeah. Exactly. Oh, there's a crypt keeper here.
Very spine tingling.
But a funny thing, though, Rob asking if we went back to the original movie, it was funny because you were saying, like, some people, I don't want to do that because you don't want to, like, put that in your head. Yeah. But the thing was, I was one of them people. I was thinking that at first. But the thing is, I saw that movie so many times growing up. It was one of my favorites. I watched it over and over again. And then I was sitting there, like, as me and Dennis were working on this, going, I'm not going to rewatch it so it doesn't influence me. And, like, I'm sitting there seeing, like, Gage in my head and the ankle cut. And I'm going, like, who am I fooling? Like, it's not, like, it's not going away. It's just because I go, we want to do our own thing. Like, it's clearly there. I can't brainwash myself and unsee the movie. So then, like, it became, well, let's go back and rewatch it and, you know, and we love that movie, but then just to refresh our minds for everything that Mary Lambert did with the movie. So that way when we went in, we could kind of approach new things and or try things differently. And in the places where we do something similar, at least like kind of like make reference to the movie. Or
and subvert like with the ankle, you know, like okay. Well, that's not in the
deep spoiler territory yet.
No, not yet. Yeah, but that's not in the book. That's something Mary Lambert did. You know, with the whole ankle thing. So we were like, okay, we're gonna reference that. Then the audience is gonna, I know where they're going with this. And then you have to somehow pull the carpet out a little bit and try. And so now you thought we were doing that. Oh, we are. You know, so it's like there we got to have fun with the audience a little
bit. Were there elements in the original movie going back to it that don't work for you now? Like without slamming the movie, because I think we all really like the movie. But I feel there's certain elements in that film that feel more dated than certain King adaptations for me personally. Central performance is a big part of that for me personally that I just don't necessarily – like the authenticity and the performances you got in the new film – are completely grounded in like this kind of realism where there's some characters in that just don't really fit like that to me anymore. But was there anything that stuck out to you when you had to remake?
I would say Pascal. Like Pascal is his own beast in the original movie and we had a lot of fun with that. But, you know, they're definitely leaning on humor there with Pascal. Yeah. And so we leaned more into the idea that there is the Wendigo, and then there might also be some other ancient spirit that he's possessed by. This is not just meaning you could look at it two different ways. Is this the spirit of the dead boy that's come back and it's his personality you're hearing, or something using his body as a vessel? So with that, we actually tried to go a different direction than the first one we did and not have him speak as much, you know, and, you know, try to make him something that you were both frightened of but was also wise. You know, to try to find that balance of, like, he's scary to look at and he's creepy and stuff, but he's actually maybe a good guy, you know? So that was one of the things we did. And then I think atmosphere was really important to us. Like, when we pitched them on this, we said, easily one of the best chapters in the book is the burial of church. And, like, Stephen King fans will say that's one of his best written chapters. And you don't even see a lot in that chapter. It's all just really auditory. You know, like, you hear the sounds of trees breaking in the distance and you don't hear a lot of birds, and you see the northern lights and stuff.
Not
it feels
King's original script. You see some things in that one.
So we were like, that's an opportunity that we haven't seen done yet where we could really make that a set piece, and you should put a little more money into that. And so our whole thing was, let's everything before the deadfall, let's actually shoot in the real woods. You know, let's be out there with the flies in the middle of the night. And everything post-deadfall, once they go over it, let's purposely do on the stage. That way we could control what the trees look like. We could, you know, control the atmosphere, you know, and we could have it feel very otherworldly and hyper-real. Because in the book, that's the way it's described. And so we purposely wanted to have it feel kind of mystical once you go over that to really make it feel like they stepped into, like, no man's land, you know.
Now, on Church, can you talk about auditioning and training cats?
Oh, God. Yeah. Well, the thing was, me and Dennis didn't think you could train cats beforehand. He has three cats. I have two cats. And if you see our apartments, like, our cats aren't trained. You just look at my furniture. And,
I just always assume cats are assholes, like, across the board.
Like, and so all my furniture is all scratched up now and everything's ruined. But it was crazy. Like, we showed what kind of cat we wanted, which was like the cat from the original hardcover. We were like, we want to get a cat that looks like this.
And that's a very specific breed of cat that is hard to find, right?
Yeah, it's very hard to find.
Maine Coon cat?
I think the cat's not a half Maine Coon, which is what we ended up with. We trained a few actual full-bred Maine Coons, and they're so distinct-looking that they didn't look like the other cats.
Yeah,
so
we had to go
with like a half-breed for the cat, you know?
But yeah, it was just funny because like they didn't have these cats. Like we were shooting like in just under like 8 weeks. They're like, okay, we'll go find some. And we're like, okay, going to just go find some cats that look like this that are trained? And like, no, we're going to train them. And I'm like, okay. You know, like,
you met cats.
Yeah. So they go out and they found some rescues. And they're like, hey, we got a couple cats that really look the part that you like. And they show us pictures. And we go, okay. And we went up. We were just getting up to Canada for preps. We went over to where they lived and where their little training facility was. And we met these cats. And like, they had just found them recently. So the cats were kind of like wandering off doing what cats do, and kind of like, you're like, hey, come over here. And they were like, hey, watch what we've taught him so far. And he would go like,
he barely
fuck off
it.
And then they're like, oh yeah, like, yeah, we were like real good, you know, like
we're so fucked.
The VFX list is gonna grow.
So we were getting like worried. We're like, okay, yeah, this is, we're gonna learn why they say never work with animals. And then and then a couple weeks later, when it was like time to shoot, I was like amazed. These cats showed up on set, and like they like all these things that they had them do. I was sitting there going, like, this is crazy. They had them like, they would have them buzzer sounds. They go, where do you want them to go? You want to walk over here? And they put a buzzer and they buzz, and the cat would walk over there. And it was like,
wow. We originally had a scene where they unpack, you know, when they first get there, and we ended up not shooting it, but that whole scene is going to be seen from the cat's point of view. So we're going to literally have the cat walk the entire house from like point to point.
Wow.
Because he was that well trained, and he could have done it. We just didn't end up doing it.
But. And you just see like the scene where we have the cat sitting in the road and like the camera just pulls back.
And he's just sitting there.
He's just sitting there. That's not any like.
People take
that
for granted how hard it is to do that. We were like, this cat is not moving right now and there's no one around him and he's just staring at the camera for like,
no kidding,
a good 10 seconds of footage.
What happened to the cats post shoot? Did they get adopted?
Yes, they did, The trainers adopted two of them. The other ones found homes too.
You can find them both on Instagram under Church AKA Tonic and Church AKA Leo.
They have their own Instagram pages. The celebrity is getting to their heads a little
bit. They're actually competing now. They're rival churches on Instagram.
Who has more followers? Good church in the back.
Ryan is following them right now.
He's
going
to look right now.
Yeah. They'll be at a convention circuit before you know it.
They'll be in New York, actually.
They're going to be at
the Tonic will be in New York at the screening because he poses on people's shoulders and stuff and just sits there.
Yeah. So. Wow. Which you could go to 2 days ago when this came out.
Yeah, were you there?
Yeah.
They're funny.
Yeah, so this is going to air Friday, the day that the movie comes out. And we've spoken enough so that if you haven't seen it yet, which if you're listening to this at like 11 a.m., you probably haven't. Yeah. We think we've given you enough. But now,
spoilers.
Pause, go see the movie, and come back, unless you don't care about spoilers. It's impossible to talk about this movie without spoilers because you guys have done some pretty serious shit here. And to be candid, I don't know. I still don't know how I feel about what you did.
Give it time.
And that's what I like about it.
Yeah.
You know, is that and unfortunately, if you've watched the second or third trailer, or even looked at
the poster or the billboard or the bus ad,
this has been ruined for you already. And I have a lot of questions about this.
Sure.
It's a change in the main character in terms of it's not Gage, it's Ellie. Was that always there? And I'm going to say this first, and you can either deny or confirm it, but the biggest reason that I think Alex Aja walked off the project is because they wouldn't let him kill Gage. And so I want, but it's in the original movie.
We
know
Aja. We've talked to him about this. He never mentioned that. So maybe not. I don't know. But he's been a big supporter of it.
No. Was that change always there, I guess? That's my question.
It's like 2013 about. Yeah. That was a Matt Greenberg draft. So that's been there for over 10 years.
And why do you think, you know, that was always the case? Was it just to really play with the audience's expectations of what happens, or?
Well, I think that, you know, and that's one of the things that I think when we were talking about changes before, where like I would read the script and things just were changed because, you know, you get into development, you go, what can we do different? And each writer that comes on or something has to put their stamp or come up with some idea because they're, you know, they're working on the script. But that one, when I first got to it, I'll admit that when I read The Change for the first time, and Dennis feels differently, but when I read The Change for the first time, I didn't instantly go, wow, that's cool, they changed the kid. Like, I went, okay, they did that. Why did they do that? Did they just do that to make it different than the other movie? Is that, did they do that, like, because they don't want to kill the kid, like you were saying? You know, and then I kept reading, and I saw the scenes that followed it, the subsequent scenes, like the bathtub scene and the going to bed scene. And I saw these relationships that they were having. I saw the way that Ellie interacted with her father. I saw the psychological themes that you could explore there. The way that Ellie in the beginning of the movie is the one asking these questions about death, asking her father, what happens after we die? Am I going to... And her father saying, don't worry, we're all going to be around for a really long time. She's the one who has the self-awareness to know what is happening to her. She's the one who has the vocality to be able to express herself and say, I thought you told me that we were going to be around, or I thought you said there wasn't anything after this. You were wrong. Like, she's the person who could challenge him and question him.
I was going to say, not only that, but also interacting with Judd.
Yeah.
You know, that's a major component that I really appreciate that you carried over from the book, or maybe it was in a previous script, but it's like, She's unraveling secrets about Judd and really poking at his dead wife, which is a huge thing. You know?
And that is in the book, which is something that a 3-year-old can't necessarily do as an actor, which in the original book it says that he speaks in perfect English, even though he's 3 years old, and he says all these things. Yeah. And it was like, so again, that's what I was saying about The Change, where like you change it to the child that has the ability to vocalize these things. And but then again, like saying that, I feel like we're staying true though to the essence of the book, because by changing the kid, we were able to do some of the things in the book that we wouldn't have been able to do otherwise.
It's like you get to a deeper thematic meaning about what death is. I mean, I think also I talked to a couple people who like Brian Sauer, right, who has a daughter who's about that age.
Yeah.
Really affected him because basically when she comes back, we're getting spoilers, but everyone knows. When she comes back, it's almost like a father's relationship to his young daughter after she's had her period, or perhaps lost their virginity for the first time. From a man's point of view, there's going to be a change from a little girl that they've had to when they come back and something's different. It doesn't mean it's, you know, radical huge shift, but there's a change. And I think the relationship you guys show on screen between those two is so interesting, because it becomes like a mini marriage. Mm-hmm. And when he lies next to her in bed, I thought that was the moment in this movie where I was like, this is a fascinating shift. It's a whole different movie because of the themes you get to explore there between these two.
It's what really made us want to do the film. You know, like when I first read it, I was floored by it, and I had to put the script down and kind of like go for a walk, where I was like, because I didn't see it coming, and up until the last minute, you think it's going to engage, and then it happened. I said, wow, okay. And it didn't feel arbitrary to me. And then I kept reading, like Kevin said, and by the time it was over, those later scenes are the ones we were most excited to direct, where we're like, because when Gage comes back in the book and the movie, it's awesome, but he kind of goes right into kill mode, you know, when we were like, the third act could be something to where you live with the craziness of this idea and you explore it a little bit. Sort of like Frankenstein meeting the girl by the water. You know, like you get to really, really get into this idea of what would those scenes be like? Like what would happen if a mother walked in and thought her daughter was dead and buried and she was standing in front of her covered in dirt? Like what really happens in that moment? You probably would go insane, you know? So then suddenly we were having conversations with Amy Simons and Jason Clark, and they were like, really like, wow, okay, this is going to be a really interesting scene. Like we're scared of the scene. We don't know how to do – this is going to be a tough scene, but like we think they killed it.
And she makes choices. I don't think Gage could really make choices. He's just doing things instinctually. She, I think there's a cunning there, and we got to see a lot of it play right before she would do things. And I found that to be – it's really exciting to see a character who has – she has a plan almost.
Yeah. Well, you know what it is? The macabre nature of seeing a 3-year-old just eating Judd's neck and killing people – I get it. It's awesome. And that's why I love the first movie in the book. But it's been done. So our whole thing was, we've all seen killer little girl movies, The Bad Seed. That's also been done. But the thing that we really liked about it was the psychological killing that she also did. It wasn't just physically killing you. It was destroying you. Like when she's talking to Amy and she's saying, you prayed your sister would die, didn't you? And she's getting to admit it. It's like having like an 8-year-old say those things and saying, I don't want her here either. And like, you know, back from where those really profound kind of morbid things to me are almost more effective than killing a person.
It's all that stuff. It's all the Wendigo stuff. It's because I had just reread the book last year.
Right.
So it all came fresh in my mind, and I was sitting there, you know, reading it going, how is this ever going to translate to a screen in 2019? It's watching a three-year-old walk around and systematically stalk and kill Judd and go after mom and go after dad, mm-hmm. and then have a voice, you know, that is so eloquent and grown up. It's like, I kind of laughed because I was like, I don't think that can ever translate today. Yeah. And that's why I kind of went in with a little bit more open-mindedness and just going, okay, I want to see what you guys do with it.
Right.
Yeah, but you knew the twist. You knew it was going to be the girl once you started watching the movie, right?
I did have that.
The second trailer very clearly shows you that it's her.
I got to say, like this whole thing of me not watching trailers, this might have been the film it most paid off in.
Yeah,
because every time, and I think the one thing you guys tripled down on, in my opinion, is people's expectations of a movie. Like, you are making a movie assuming, I think this movie's best for people who've seen the original Pet Sematary.
Well, then let's dive into that, because we were talking before we went on air about the this is your first big studio movie, and there's a way that things get put out into the world.
Yeah.
And I feel, as a fan, that the second trailer and the third trailer and the poster give away all of your best surprises, but there's reason for it, and I'm just, you know, because Elric got to see this. I'm jealous.
He got to see it really is great, so blindly.
And when you watch the movie compared to the trailers, it's not out of context.
Right.
It's like you guys were like playing with what people already know.
It's the whole setup to those scenes
were all like, you know, and so it's kind of a bummer that it gets spoiled in that way.
It is.
Oh, they were definitely orchestrated to fool you.
Yeah, sure.
No, of course. Like, I mean, anytime you make a movie, you have to make a movie thinking that people are watching the movie from the beginning and things are naturally progressing. And yes, we were playing with expectations because we know people might have read the book or saw the original movie. You can't know what people are going to put in a trailer. But that said, I mean, the thing was, with Starry Eyes, we actually told Dark Sky, well, no, we don't want any of the stuff from the second half in the trailer because we didn't want people to know. And again, now we're in spoiler territory. So here's a Starry Eyes spoiler.
Starry Eyes.
We didn't want people to know that Sarah, you know, your lead in the movie, your hero, actually ends up kind of being the villain or being the bad person in this movie. So basically all the Starry Eyes trailers are like, hey, girl goes on an audition, the production company's weird, you know, like,
friends
and it's
jerks.
Just kind of like, it doesn't really show you what the plot of the movie is. So the funny thing is, even though by us changing which kid it is, it now gets seen as a twist. Like, oh, that's the twist, because you changed a kid from the boy to the girl. It's now considered a twist. But the thing is, it's not really a twist. It's just the plot that we changed. Because if you look back at the original movie, Gage is in the trailer. You know, Gage coming back's in the trailer. They tell you in the trailer, like, okay, there's this place, blah, blah, blah. And now guess what? They're going to lose a kid.
You see the truck hit him in the trailer.
He's going to come back. Yeah. You know, like, so basically, like, by us considering that to be a twist, that we made a change, you're now cutting off the movie at a certain point to where the marketing department was telling us, okay, we did the first trailer, but the way that marketing rolls out movies nowadays, you do three or something.
Mm-hmm.
You expand upon the things. It's like, we already did the first trailer where, like, we tease this out. You know, if we can't show the second half of the movie, there's really nothing we could kind of promote.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, we were definitely conflicted about it. We won't lie. Like, we were, like, hoping they wouldn't. And but then when they did, they were so sweet about it. I mean, like, all the marketing guys had multiple conversations with us, like calling our personal cell phones from their cell phones on the weekend to talk about us. They were really, like, nice about it. There was nothing corporate about it at all. Mm. And in the end, it was, hey, guys, we tested multiple versions of the trailer, in every instance, this one scored better, right? But it wasn't just that, though. It was that the film in general, when we showed the film to test audiences, the way you do this, Burbank, Long Beach, Northridge, you go to all these different theaters in different cities, and you show versions of the movie. In between our last two screenings, that trailer dropped, trailer two, that spoiled the Ellie thing. And then suddenly our scores went way up, where it was almost like people went into it now knowing and sort of wrapping their head around it, and now they were just along for the ride. And like Kevin was saying, that wasn't a twist to them anymore, but everything that followed it was different. It was a reveal. I mean, a whole third act is very different. You know?
Yeah.
So that was how we just had to start to owning it, saying, all right, they need something to put on the poster, and she looks damn good, and she sounds damn good, and no one has any idea all the mayhem she's going to cause in that third act. So we eventually came to grips with it. But yeah, at first it was sort of like pulling a Band-Aid off. But I never thought I would admit this, but I think in the end they might have been right about it. You know?
I'm like Elric. Like, I went to the New Bev twice last week. I went on Monday, and then I knew I was coming back on Wednesday, and they have their
coming attractions, and it's all the movies that they're showing there. So all of a sudden, there's the trailers for the movies that I'm going to see Wednesday. So I'm like, you know, I'm looking down at my seat, and I'm like, I'm humming to myself. So I can't hear what's saying, like, so that they don't spoil that movie that came out 30 something years ago or 40 something years ago, you know. And you know, and I don't really want to know these things, but at the same time, I don't know. That's what these people do, and it's weird. They apparently like told us that with comedies, like all the jokes that are in the trailer that everybody's seen already are the ones that get laughed at the most in the movie theater. Or like it's strange.
But also, they're waiting for it, so that's why.
It's also that's not the only twist in this movie, and I think that's the key. Like when we're talking about expectations, there's other things like the notorious slashing that I just thought was play. I'm not even going to ruin it here, but it was play.
That's in the trailer.
That's in the trailer.
Oh, really?
It's in there.
Wait,
it's all in
there. The misdirect.
Rob is not completely wrong here.
Yes.
Oh, really?
That's revealed in the trailer.
That was beautiful. With an audience, I thought that was a beautiful moment because everyone's like, you know, like
I know, but you know what though? Even I think Rob, even the people that saw, maybe not you, but people that saw in the trailer too. Like I think that still probably was effective for them. You know,
I think would be interesting. I think you should watch the trailer now.
I should watch. He actually told me to watch the trailer.
Here's the other angle I just want to bring up. There's a generation that has no idea what Pet Sematary is.
Well, that's the other thing too. Yeah.
And there's like
There's
an entire teenage audience that doesn't know the original story. I know. Doesn't know the original.
They're
film.
Gonna watch it on Netflix one day. They're not gonna watch a trailer. And they're gonna have no idea what it is.
Well, they're gonna watch a trailer and go, oh, cool.
Yeah. You have to make the movie for those people. You know? So it's like you know.
Is anything in the last 20 minutes of the film in the trailer?
Oh yeah.
Like so,
right.
The very end, even the very end.
No.
Okay. Oh yeah,
like I think that goes in an extreme.
But like pretty much like 8 out of 9 of the big jump scare. No,
they play the cover of the Ramones song over the trailer.
So who knows, man?
You know, I mean, can't spoil John Lithgow. Yeah. I mean, once you put John Lithgow in your movie, I don't think you can spoil. I mean,
I do have a question about this because all right, so setting the scene. I'm in Montreal at Fantasia,
right?
And everybody who's there, who's super cool in the horror scene, they're all checking out the script. We're all at a screening, and I'm like, "Hey, what are you guys doing tomorrow? Let's go grab lunch." And they're like, "Oh no, Paramount's coming to pick us up and take us to the set of Pet Sematary." And I was like, "No,
we could have got you in."
And then they all came back. I caught them like much later on, and I'm not going to spoil who, but I was like, "What did it look like?" And they're like, "Oh my god, it's amazing!" And I was like, "How's Lithgow's accent?"
Right.
And they were like, "No accent." And I was like, "What?"
Oh, wow.
And I never heard why. So I want to hear why. Yeah. Please.
Well, I'll tell you though, first on that day when I remember sitting there looking at Ryan's unpicked up pass going like, I guess he didn't want to come back.
I think I was visiting the Of Unknown Origin house that day.
There you go. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Wait. Peter Weller?
Yeah. It's in Montreal.
Brian Collins.
Right back to Cobra.
It's a good movie. Yeah, Panos. Not Panos. George Cosby. Panos should remake it.
Shit.
But Cobra first. I want to remake Cobra. Screw that. So here's the story with the accent was so John knew Fred Gwynne. They were friends. They were in a play together. He used to always joke around that Fred was the only actor taller than him because Fred Gwynne's 6'5 and John's 6'4.
Wow.
So his whole thing was John purposely never watched the first film because he didn't want to be influenced by it. And he didn't want to do what his friend was doing, you know, because he respected him. And he's like, that's his performance. I want to do my performance. And yet still, he was very willing to do the accent. He hosted SNL like decades ago, and there was a skit where he plays like some Maine grandpa from Maine, you know, and he does the accent perfectly. So we went back and forth on it, and we always left it up to John. We said, John, if you don't want to do it, you're not comfortable with it, it's fine. And he was comfortable with it. He can nail it. But he said, you know, I think I kind of want to do my own thing. So we were like, okay. Then we get to Montreal, and we sit down to do the table read. And he does the entire table read in the Maine accent. So we're like, oh, so he's doing it. I guess he's going to do the Maine accent, right? So we were like, okay. And then we talked about it afterwards. He's like, so I just wanted to do it to show you guys I can do it, you know? But what do you guys think? And we were like, John, honestly, it's up to you. Like, we've heard both and they both sound great. But, you know, we had to admit, when you hear him do the Maine accent even perfectly, you can't help but not think of Fred Gwynne because Fred Gwynne was also just doing a Maine accent. Mm. Like, if we all did the Maine accent right now, we're going to sound like
Fred
Gwynne.
We're going to sound like Fred Gwynne. Like, you can't say Dead is Better without that accent.
Dead is Better. Yeah, you're going to draw these comparisons. So at the end of the day, we said, you know what? This is John fucking Lithgow. The guy's 2-time Oscar nominee, you know? Like, his own voice is great, and he's going to bring something to it, like a country charm.
Yeah.
And so in the end, he goes, I think I'm going to do my own thing. And we supported him on it, and we think it was great, you know? Cool. But he gave me the option, though.
Yeah. That's cool.
Satisfied? Damn.
So. But talk about the casting of all of them, because I think they're all – what I love about this movie most is that I believe that this is a real family.
Right.
I believe in the loss. I believe in the grief. I believe the way each person is going through their individual stories, like Amy's story with Zelda encroaching on her every day is, I think, a really smart choice. And then Jason Clark's character breaking away into this basically two-person relationship with his you know, returned daughter. So just I think Jason Clark is a huge – to me, that's the one key improvement. Mm-hmm. On this film, just getting an actor of that caliber to make this feel real. Like, he sells that this isn't just a horror movie to me. This feels like it's a real happening.
Right.
Like, this guy's really experienced it. He had to drug a guy and then dig up his daughter's corpse and bring her back, you know? And, so just talk about how you, like, settled on them and, you know, what they each brought, because I think Amy's also inspired at casting.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Jason, you know, he's one of them guys. Like, I used to work at Deluxe in New York, the Post House, and, like, I'd be doing like dailies on movies, or I'd be doing transfers of films, you know, tape dubs and whatever. And I'd always be watching all these movies as like they played, you know, like, and I kept seeing him pop up and all these things. And I was always like, who's this guy? He's always popping up. He's always interesting. And he always stole like every scene he was in. And then like, you know, and then he started just kind of getting these bigger roles and popping up everywhere. And like when we came into this, we were just like, you know, we want that guy. That guy is like, he's really great. He's, you know, like we said, he steals all the scenes he's in. We want to give him this leading role, you know? And
he has a real dad too, right?
Yeah, he has a real dad. He has a kid about Gage's age.
Yeah, he brought him to set. Yeah.
Yeah, he brought him. We had a family fun day before we shot to try and get the family all like, you know, kind of bonded and stuff.
He brought his kid. Yeah.
He brought his kid, you know, to kind of help ease up, you know, warm up the other kids. You know,
yeah, it's funny too, man. He has, on the one hand, an everyman quality, very grounded quality, and then sometimes he has like a real bigger-than-life movie star quality. It's weird. Like, he goes back and – he's like a chameleon. I don't know how he does it. Like, I'll see him in interviews and I'll see him in certain lights. I'm like, oh my God, the guy's a movie star. And then I'll also go like, no, but I also feel like he's a real dad. I buy him. You know, he's not too larger than life. He fits in this movie, you know?
He was in that TV show that's set around there, Brotherhood.
Yeah.
That's where and he's an Aussie, so I never never knew he was an Aussie. Watching that, I thought he's from Boston.
Yeah.
So it made sense to cast him from that area.
Yeah. He's probably played more like Americans at this point in his career than Aussies, you know?
Yeah.
And how did Amy get on the radar?
Well, Amy's someone like, you know, that's been floating in the same circles as us. Like, we all know, you know, people who have directed movies that Amy's been in and started in movies, you know.
And she's a filmmaker.
Sacrament,
so
you're next.
Listening, yeah.
Yeah, so Amy was one of those people where we were like, is she going to be too busy directing and producing her own stuff? And so when we reached out to Amy, because she was our first choice, she treated it like a vacation. She's like, oh, I could be on set for like a few months and like not have to direct, produce. I could just act. I would love to do that. That'd be a vacation for me. So she was like really gung-ho to kind of get into it. And the cool thing about Amy is that, because she's been in so many horror movies, she has that sort of like shorthand with us where she understands horror language. Mm-hmm. You could talk to her like in horror references and stuff. And she always knows that sometimes you got to go a little bigger for the editing, you know? So whenever it was like, okay, Amy, Zelda's coming out of the ventilation, you're freaking out, you know? And she just knew how to bring that like that hyper reality to all these scenes that you want to be able to just mute the screen and just look at her reacting, and it just feels like a horror movie. So she understood when to go with big horror and when to go with subtle horror, you know? And like, God, man, like 80% of her scenes in the movie call for her to be very vulnerable and very emotional and really wounded by her past, you know? And some people can't do that. And she was always willing just to turn it on like that. You know, she could bring it so easily. Yeah. So we were, I mean, she really got put through it on this film. You know, and when you look at the arcs in the film, her arc is one of the most interesting arcs because, I mean, look at the way the movie begins. And this is something that Kevin and I like doing. We did this with Starry Eyes, too, where you call it like a crisscrossing arc. So in the beginning, you have Sarah looking in a mirror, Sarah Walker in Starry Eyes, and she's hating her body, hating herself, has no confidence whatsoever. And you're with her. She's a girl next door, and her friends are all like the hipster douchebags, and I hate them. They're the competition. And by the end of the movie, the friends are the ones trying to help her and get her to the hospital, and she's the one killing everyone. And you're like, she's a monster. Where at the beginning of this, you have Amy, who's the character that's frightened of death because she's experienced it firsthand with her sister. And then you have Lewis, who is an emergency room doctor, and he's seen it every day, and he thinks he understands death. And he's the one that's almost kind of condescending to her. Like, we should be able to talk to our daughter about death, you know? And, you know, and he's not saying it, but he really just wants her to get off her butt and go in the bedroom and tell the daughter, your cat's dead, you know? And so he very reluctantly says, okay, we'll say the cat ran away. He goes against his better judgment.
And by the end of the movie, the two of them swapped, where now he's the one that's a believer. He's the one that will do anything he can to undo death, where she's the one that comes to grips with death. She's the one that's able to look her undead daughter in the eyes and say, "You're not my daughter. My daughter's dead." Whereas earlier in the movie, she's the one saying anything but dead. So she's the one that in the end comes through with the victory. You know, like in the end, she's the one who goes through this big change. And you realize the two of them crisscrossed and they got to very different places in the end, you know. So she really saw that and she said, "Wow, okay, I see what you're doing here. And I love this. I'm okay beginning the film as this wounded person because I know where I'm going in the end." You know?
Yeah. Funny story, though, about casting her was that we really wanted her to do this movie. So, but we were already in Canada, so we were talking to her on Skype, and the funny thing is, as everybody can see in the movie, she's really good at playing like wounded and has an intense emotion in her face. So we're on Skype, and everybody knows how Skype works. We're like, you barely hear people sometimes, and there's delays and all that. So she was like leaned in and looked like trying to concentrate and hear what we were saying, but she looked like so intense. And you always get that Skype delay, so we'd be like sitting there going like, "So yeah, we just really want you to do this movie." And then like we look back and she's just on the screen like staring with this like intense face, and we were like, "Oh god, she hates this movie. She doesn't want to do it." You know,
like, she's like, "You guys."
And then all of a sudden, like after like a second of going like this, her face would like lighten up. She goes, "Yeah, I really want to do it." We were like,
"Yeah." So. And she was a big fan of the original, right? Like I thought from the Q&A, it seemed like she.
Oh yeah,
really
she's
liked
a king nut. You know, okay, she was reading like Cujo at age like 8, I think. Yeah. So like she, I mean, all the actors were. I mean, Jason Clarke and John Lithgow purposely didn't watch the first movie, but everybody read the book. Mm-hmm. Everybody was very respectful of the book and of Stephen King. And I think Jason read it like 3 times on set. Like he knew everything. Wow. You know, you could ask him like what the character said on page 87, and he knew. So he was always. He's calling us on a Sunday night saying, "We got to get this line in." You know, like there's a line which he says, like, about Ellie says the whole thing about, "Why can't God have his own cat?" You know, so then we didn't get to have that moment, but then we had the moment where Jason says, "Let God take his own fucking kid." You know, we were like, "Oh wow, he's found a way to bring that line into," you know, and it was, I think that was almost improv when he said it. We were like, "Wow, he's channeling this so perfectly." Awesome. You know?
Yeah, and like the hug your daughter line that's all over the trailers and people were hashtagging. I think Jason,
it was improv,
too.
Well,
you know,
yeah,
like,
just said that. Yeah.
Hug your daughter, yeah.
Hug your daughter, but, screaming, you're like, "Oof."
Yeah, but it was funny because Jason would sometimes even like slip in some lines while we were on, while we were like rolling, and then we'd go like, "What was that line?" And then we'd like come over and we'd go like, "Hey, Jason, I don't know, you read this other line there. I think just stick to the script line." And he'd go like, "You sure? It's from the book."
Enough with the book, Jason.
Wow. And we go like, "Okay."
Well, let's talk about what you brought back in from the previous draft I had read was Zelda.
Yeah.
Yes. In this incarnation, Zelda is more of, to me, it's more of a feeling, mm-hmm. a representation of this guilt, a representation of pain. Yeah. She doesn't talk all that much, whereas in the original, in Mary Lambert's version, she is very aggressive. She's you know, this kind of cackling, nasty crone.
Well, Ted Raimi-esque, we'd
always
say.
Yeah, for sure.
Which we love, by the way.
But you were able to maximize Zelda's representation to scare, very scary effect.
Just right.
The first jump scare beyond the truck is
where it drops down.
Where she drops down through the dumbwaiter. Fucking scared the shit out of me. But just talk about going into, how, you know, again, you're trying to think about an audience who has never seen the film before and not familiar with the book, but you're also trying to keep in mind the fans who are very familiar with the original. So just talk about how, you know, your approach to Zelda.
Well, I mean, we thought long and hard about Zelda. And we, at first we were fighting to put her in. And then once we had her in the script, we were like, maybe we shouldn't do this. So like, Mary Lambert Zelda's so good. Like, we can't. And then we stopped saying, let's try to do better and top that, and just said, let's just do something different. Let's let that exist where it is, and let's do our own thing. So our big in with that character was she's 11 or 12 years old, or 12 or 13 in the book. And we were like, okay, A, let's really get a character, an actress that is that age. Okay, how old is Amy's character? So you do the reverse engineering of the math, and you go, okay, so that she would have died in like the late 80s. Okay, so then we could actually show that she was a real little girl in the 80s. So rather than her living in some like gothic attic, she's living in what was once a little girl's room, where it's kind of dated, and there's like nightgowns and old stuffed animals and like Debbie Gibson and Kirk Cameron posters. Ah. But everything's covered. That's the biggest villain moment. That's the scariest scene.
Long Island.
Everything's covered in like a layer of dust. There's like abandoned medical equipment. The parents have kind of just given up on her, and she's just festering up there. And we like, that's the real horror, the idea that if you look at the ground and nature of it, even if you take all the scares out and all the subjectivity and the hyper, you know, realness of those scenes, and you just look at the reality of what was going on, we were like, that in itself is a horror movie, the medical trauma of the whole thing. And then we brought in this aspect of playing up the guilt more, you know? And that's in the book a lot, and it's definitely in Mary Lambert's version as well, where I think she chokes while she's feeding her. And so our whole thing was, what if she was too scared to even go back in the room, you know? And because she was too frightened of her, it led to what happened. So in some ways, it's you could look at it two different ways. You could look at it as, well, Zelda was probably resentful of her because she was the sister that wasn't sick. So what would that torment be? That torment would be, one day you're going to get sick. One day you're never going to get out of bed again.
Right.
And then because obviously we love body horror, we're like, okay, then where can we take that? Like, what would Rachel's biggest fear really be? It wouldn't just be guilt. It would be that someday
that
she'll
can,
get
that
me.
Can catch
this,
up to me.
This will happen to me. And so that just opened up the floodgates. We were like, oh, wow, okay, we could really, really dial this up a notch.
Yeah.
Well, why does it happen to her character in that once she gets to the house? Why is all this coming back? Is it the location of the house, the presence of the past guilt coming up?
That was one of the things that we were conscious of, was that, you know, Rachel has this guilt and she has this trauma from when she was a child, but she also is married and has two kids. So, like, she's not just, like, walking around broken all the time going, like, oh, my sister. You know, like, like she's living a life, you know. So there has to be something that is bringing it back to the surface now. And if you read in the book, it's like when they talk about the burial ground, like – Judd says, like, who knows how far the influence of that place reaches. That you know, like, and, you know, this place feeds on your grief. And it's and so it's kind of coming to this place and all these things, like from the cat being killed or the second that they move in, you know, they see the kids doing the procession.
So, like, seeps over the line.
It's like it's in the air.
Death is in the air, and it starts all coming back to her. It's boiling up to the surface there. And that's why we kind of had – a balancing act with Zelda. Like, if you guys see when the movie comes out on digital media, like, there's bonus features, there's some extra Zelda scenes. It was just kind of like a balance of, like, enough Zelda to feel like, why now? You know, why is this happening to Rachel now? You know, like, to really feel like this is bubbling into the surface, but we also, you know, there's some stuff in the deleted scenes because we didn't want it to all of a sudden become the Zelda show, you know, because, like... Yeah. There's a central plot that's going on. So it was finding this balancing act. But yes, it does all tie into the place in the woods and the influence of this burial ground and the spirit that is in the woods and how far it pulls.
It's a chain reaction. I mean, like, think about it. The minute they get there, they see the procession. The second day they're there, the daughter's intrigued by it. The mom's not. The mom says, let's go back inside. What's the first thing that happens when the mom goes inside? She's unpacking, and a photo of Zelda falls out of her diary that she probably hasn't looked at in years. Then the daughter sneaks out because it's too late. She's stained. She's already seen the procession. So now she sneaks off to go see the cemetery. She meets Judd. That night, she asks about death and the cat dying. That leads to a conversation between the parents. It's just a chain reaction that keeps getting out of trouble. But it really begins the minute they get there. It's almost like it was predestined. Like they were doomed, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Which is an idea that we like a lot in horror movies, where, like, it was, like, always meant to happen.
Yeah. You know? But also it's like – again, like, from that thing that we were talking about the parents not being – when you talk about crisscrossing arcs, like, communication, the parents not being able to talk about these things and not being on the same page with their beliefs is what kind of leads to all these things. Because if you look, what these kids are doing is they're having a funeral for their deceased pet, you know, which is a way of coping with death. Like, even like John Lithgow says in the Pet Cemetery, says people do it as a way of coping. And the Pet Cemetery exists where it does before the deadfall, because it's supposed to be, hey, come have a ritual, bury your pet here, don't go beyond there. Sure. You know, so if Rachel didn't, like, turn up her nose at the idea of these kids and think it seemed morbid and I don't want to deal with it, maybe when Church died, it would have been like, hey, let's go up there like those kids did. Let's have a funeral. Let's bury your pet. Let's put it to rest, you know, because that's why we do these things. That's why we have death rituals as a way of coping with our grief, you know. So her kind of inability or unwillingness to kind of face these issues is what – and you see it right there in that first scene with the procession – is what leads down this entire path.
Yeah. I know we're running out of time, but I got to squeeze in a couple of quick questions before we wrap up. Number one, the ending or third act – is really, really dark. And I know you tested this movie a few times.
Yeah.
Was the projector working correctly?
Don't spoil the very end, because Beck hasn't seen it.
I haven't seen it yet.
And it has got a pretty amazing ending. So
don't want to spoil the actual one, but I'm just saying, like, was there – I can't believe you got away with such a dark ending in 2019.
We have another ending too.
And so was that what you intended? Because, again, I know you tried different endings, but was this the one you always wanted to be the ending? And
no, the ending that will be in the home media, you know, Blu-ray ending was the scripted ending that's not in the film, which is just as dark as this.
Yeah.
This is probably darker. So, yeah, I mean, to the studio's credit, there was that opposite discussion about it. You know, there was sometimes like, what does a happy ending of this movie look like? And we used to talk about it and go like, well, what happens? Like the daughter dies and then they come to grips with it and then they're like driving away from the cemetery at the end, going back to Boston.
The carpet like, bomb there.
Well, you win some, you lose some. You know, it's like
– there is no happy – the most you can do is break even. Like I mean, the Pet Cemetery at its nature
is
about –
You had two kids.
That's
why you had two.
I mean, like they lost a child, you know? Like there's no way to be happy, you know? Like there's a way to, you know – to break even and go, we'll deal with our grief instead of continuing to spiral down this path. But like, I mean, it's still not happy.
Yeah, we, and we always talk to the studio about this, saying, look, if you guys, the irony is, if you try to have a happy ending, it's going to be more unsettling. Mm-hmm. If you try to have a version where they learn their lesson and they just go to the funeral at the end and bury their daughter and they go home, that's a bigger bummer. Like the ending you need that's darker is actually kind of more fun. It's the ending where it all spirals into shit.
It's the best outcome for everybody.
Yeah, like it spirals into shit, and like that's dark, but that's also like fun for the audience. It's morbid, and you get to like have your cake and eat it too. You get your themes across, but you do so in a fun, kind of messed up way.
It's out of control.
Yeah. Yeah. Can we cut Becca's headphones off? Because I have a question.
I'm fine. I don't know.
You didn't hear the very end. The very end's so good.
No, it's not about the very end. It's how the cold open ties into the very
You see the film a second time, it takes on a whole different
You need to pay attention.
Yes.
So Becca, when you go in, pay attention
to the
very
open. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes. You could kind of piece together what happened after the credits rolled by watching the beginning of the movie.
Oh, I see
so fucked up.
And it is really messed up.
And again, they let us get away.
And the last one was the review that I'm sure you're waiting for.
Right.
What does Stephen King think of it?
Haven't you guys been emailing him?
Well, Stephen King has seen it, which was funny though, because like people always ask if he was involved in the making of the film. And what's cool about Stephen King is he understands that, like, you know, film is a separate language, and he lets filmmakers go off and make their version of what it is. So he wasn't involved in the movie, but like, then that makes it all the more stressful when you're done, because then you have to like go to the guy and go like, here's what we did with your thing. Like, hope you like it. You know, like, Like we heard – when we heard that like he was watching it, he was down in a theater in Florida with like just two other people, like his manager and somebody else or something, and they had like a private screening for him. And like we were told like Stephen King's watching the movie now. And then like we were like sitting there like – checking our phones every second, going, is there an update? Or like, he's this far in. Oh my God, he's probably just now, he's probably on the truck crash.
Why is he tweeting from the movie right now?
He's not paying attention.
What's he thinking? Yeah, he was all of a sudden there was a tweet about Trump or something. But no, and then we were like waiting and we're like, and then like at the end, like, we hear from somebody, like one of the producers, like, okay, he just got out of it. He said he liked it or whatever. We're like, okay, what else did he say? And he's like, he didn't tell me anymore yet. He was, you know, he's sitting with it. And you know, we're like, well, you know, like, and then we're like, oh, well, thanks. I guess we'll go home and just like, you know,
And then he called Lorenzo that night and for like an hour was like raving about it, and then called him again the next day. And then Lorenzo finally called us and was like, he really liked it a lot. He thought it was real just scary. He loved all the family stuff we did. And then he tweeted twice about it the next day. And then EW just interviewed him, and he was like, it's really fucking good. What else did he say? And then they asked him about the twist, too, and he had a pretty cool quote.
Oh, yeah, about the switch to Ellie. He said, you could take – I don't know what the numbers were. He goes, you're driving to Tampa. You could take route whatever to Tampa. You could take route whatever to Tampa. And he goes, either way, you're getting to Tampa.
And, that's why he's such a good writer.
No, but like – but the funny thing is he says that, and it's funny, but like that's exactly what we were saying before, was that we made some changes, but we wanted to at least stay true to the essence, or you still had to feel like this was Pet Cemetery in the end. And basically by him saying that, he was like, yeah, you took some different roads, but in the end, it's still Pet Cemetery.
Yeah. So the email was real sweet.
So he was telling us that we did that because some
fucking
of the changes –
like he said in the email, we're like,
because I mean, some of the changes, though, even when I don't know, I didn't write Pet Cemeteries, the novel, so like, I can't say it's still true to the essence. We're just doing it by
hoping it is.
Yeah. So, you know, like when he comes out and said that, he felt that it was like a huge relief off, you know?
Yeah.
I still don't think it's real. I think somebody has a Stephen King Twitter account or something.
All right, guys. Well, enjoy your weekend ahead. Everybody go see Pet Sematary in theaters now.
Oh, are they going to run down their kings, or do we not have time for the King 3?
We have 10 minutes.
Oh, we have 10. All right.
What are real quick?
Top 10. Yes. Top three favorite King movies.
We'll go back and forth.
No, King adaptations.
Well, I was funny. I was listening in the other room to the intro, and I got to say, me and Elric, we align with a lot of things.
So you just wrote Shining like 3 times in a row, and that's it? Right.
No, well.
You go first. You say your three first. Yeah.
Okay, well,
because Dennis is here to cause trouble.
He's here to cause trouble. No! But I will say this: I'll throw a trouble one in. But I know Elric. I heard some of your choices, Elric. You guys picked 5. I agree with three of Elric's. I would say The Shining, which I know, like when you say it, it's on the top of like
boring.
Yeah, that's why you say it, because you go, Elric's going to say it. But it's, but like. It's on the
there's a podcast that just broke down the top 7, and they purposely voted it off, that the Screen Draft show. They purposely voted off because it's not a good King adaptation.
Oh, please.
And that is, to me, a total misinterpretation of what an adaptation is.
Right, yeah.
For cinema. You're
it's
making
not
a movie.
It's transcription, it's adaptation.
Yeah, no. It's like you're trying to bring your own flair to it.
Yeah, right. I know, and I heard you say that in the intro as well, and I agree. No, but yeah, I think like it's just, you know, I gotta say it. I know you go, oh, boring, but I have to say it. I mean, it's on the top of any horror movie list, even when you're not talking about Stephen King. It's one of the best horror movies ever made, and I have to say it. You know?
Okay.
Do you want to say one?
No, you go. You say your three.
You can go back and forth.
Okay. Well, I obviously agree, but I was going to switch it up a little bit. I was going to go with ones that I love almost as much as that aren't, you know, the big obvious ones, you know, like The Shining and stuff. So my first would be Christine, which I think the more I watch Christine, the more I realize how much I love that film. I saw it as a kid and liked it. You know, it was like a movie you watch at HBO as a kid. And then I didn't see it again for like 20 years. And then I saw a Blu-ray of it, and it's fucking gorgeous. I think it's one of Carpenter's like nicest photographed films.
The 4K is beautiful.
Yeah, and Keith Gordon's performance is so dark.
Terrific.
It's so good. Yeah. And I mean, the metaphor of it is so strong about, you know, it just goes to dark places, you know, and by the end, you're just like, Jesus, man. But I don't think there's a bad minute in that entire film. So I would say Christine, currently for me.
All right, Kevin. Okay.
Number 2. Oh, surprise again, Carrie. Well, no, I mean, Carrie is one of, like, my earliest Stephen King experiences. Like, when I was younger, I'm the youngest of 6 kids. So when I was younger, I remember, like, being off hiding in my dining room, peeking into the living room. My sisters were watching Carrie. And I remember seeing Piper Laurie getting the knives in her and nailed into, like, the door frame at the end. And that was, like, that was an image that kind of, like, stuck with me for years, and even like, you know, what that was mirroring, the little statue in like the closet where they put Carrie in, and that was always like burned into my brain. And then I remember when I got into Stephen King, one of the earliest books I read was Carrie, because of that moment was burned into my brain. And then I read it, and then like again, now that I had read the book, I went back and I watched the movie now, not as a child like that, as you know, as an older teen, and then as a young adult. And it's just like, I mean, me and Dennis all the time when we're talking about just influences, always Brian De Palma comes up. So I'm like, not even with Stephen King adaptations, it's like Brian De Palma is like a master at the craft. And it's like there's so much stuff visually in that movie, but also at the same time, I think it just sums up what Stephen King does perfectly, that it is about a character, a relatable character, and the horror is stemming and working kind of in line with what is happening to that character in her regular life, you know. And it's like such a relatable story. The character of Carrie and her mom is, and their relationship is so good, so perfect. You know, the story of her with the bullies is so relatable, and it's so well executed there. And like, and then just like I said, the execution of like that final scene at the prom and on is just masterclass of cinema.
I'll say Misery for number 2. I mean, Misery is one of the earliest books of his I read, and I think I read the book after I saw the movie. And I think it's one of the best survival movies, one of the best contained horror films. And sort of like Carrie, it's like a masterclass in tension, you know? The humor, the tone, the atmosphere of the snowstorm, you know, the performances of the two leads and stuff. So Misery is one of those films that every time I watch it, it's like watching it for the first time. And I go, God, this is such a – I would love to make a movie like that.
Yeah.
So Misery would be your next one.
All right. Well, number three – I might change it up on now because I was originally going to agree with Elric and say The Dead Zone as my number three.
How do you know my picks?
I listened to the beginning.
I know. That's all.
Oh. They don't know your picks yet.
No, that's okay.
We recorded this in reverse. Oh, sorry.
My picks have all changed since I did that.
But no, but when I was coming here, I was going to say The Dead Zone, but thinking about it, I realized that maybe it still is true, but I haven't seen The Dead Zone recent enough to know.
I watched it a few weeks ago.
Know that it still is my top. I'm just going off of my memory of what it meant to me when I watched it when I was younger. But what I have rewatched recently and still loved was Stand By Me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's flawless movie.
Yeah.
So.
Too easy, Kevin. Pick another one.
Yeah, too easy.
Don't listen.
Stand by Me is too easy.
I was gonna go with Stand by Me.
Yeah. Too good.
Yeah, that's like picking Shawshank. You can't do that.
But I'm gonna go with Shawshank.
Like, wait, I just realized. Though, every time we listen to you guys, when you give lists, I hear people go, "Well, that'll be on my regular top 10 list. It's not horror." So I realized these don't count.
See, yeah.
Y'all flunked this assignment. I'm going with my favorites.
I put my favorites, not the ones that I consider to be like the masterclass ones Shawshank I consider just to be a flawless movie.
Yeah. Well, I have to clear the air then, because The Shining and Carrie are my two favorites. And like I said, I picked Stand By Me because I hadn't seen Dead Zone recently enough to know that it's still
fair enough.
Feels to me not as a masterclass. I can tell you it's a masterclass. I know. I can remember the shot. But I'm talking about favorites.
If you
I
want
know
a great,
the other one still means something to me personally.
I've already said two favorites that mean something. If you want a great adaptation, I think Mike Flanagan's Gerald's Game is one of his best adaptations.
Yeah, that was nipping at the heels of
that is an impossible
too.
Book. Yeah. I read that book going like, how would they
it's
ever?
It's so fucked
did
up.
It.
That book.
He somehow did it. So I mean, hats off. Yeah. You know?
Okay, then I'm going to go with Ryan. As well, with one of my favorites, Maximum Overdrive.
Oh,
yeah.
How'd you get inside my head, Kevin? How'd you get in my head?
Now you're just kissing ass to King. Yeah. If he's listening, you're like,
so let's.
I watched it recently. I love it.
Let's kiss ass to King. Yeah. If there's one King thing that you still think needs to be taken to screen, what would it be? I mean, we always hear The Longest Mile and From Buick 8,
Insomnia,
but Insomnia.
Yeah. Yeah, there's the Longest Walk script.
Longest Walk.
We read it recently. It's actually pretty good.
Yeah, yeah, I
the
love
Longest
that one.
Green Mile.
Oh! Yeah.
I would say
mashup.
I'm going to go with Salem's Lot. Which I think they are, and I love the Tommyknockers. I know they're making that. I think they're making Salem's Lot.
Are they doing Tommyknockers now?
James Wan's producing it, yeah.
Are you serious?
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, there was in the original. It is not on my list. I loved the book. I remember seeing
that
the movie.
Book is batshit.
And and the book is completely batshit. And the movie is batshit. And parts of it really do not work at all.
Parts
but there
of it?
Are some parts of it that are. But there's a couple moments in it that are creepy as fuck.
I gotta see it again.
You do. Like, there's like.
Tracy Lords, Jimmy Smith.
Tracy Lords.
There's
two
moments where I'm like, oh, that was bad. And then, but the rest of it is just doesn't work. But then there are these moments that are just
that was
creepy.
I love that book.
So yeah, there's a couple of
actually
moments.
You guys, we can keep going because Dennis just missed his flight. We're actually good to just keep taping.
They really need to get on our flight. All right.
You got one. You got another one. What do you make?
Yeah. No, he did.
No, he did three.
No, he did his three.
What do you want to make?
What would you make?
One that hasn't been made. Yeah.
Yeah. Not sure. We always talk about there's so many stuff, so many great things in all his short works that haven't been explored. Mm-hmm. You know, like one of my favorite things, I don't know how you turn into a feature, but one of my things was in Nightmare and Dreamscapes. They had the teleplay for the Tales from the Dark Side episode of Sorry, Right Number.
That's right, yeah.
That thing was great. And it deals with like a telephone thing. And I always tell people like whenever we talk like ghost stories or something, the only time any like weird mystery of the unknown kind of thing ever happened to me, it dealt with a telephone and stuff. So I've always had this sort of connection to that one. And but I don't know what the feature version of it is, but maybe Sorry, Right Number.
Yes. Rainy Season, the end of the whole mess.
I also had a band named Rainy Season. I did. It's true.
Magnolia beat him to it. So
cool. All right, guys.
Excellent, guys.
Thank you so much
for
coming on.
Well done.
Thank you.
Have a safe flight.
Thank you. That was fun. Yeah.
Thank you to our listeners. Don't forget to rate and review us on iTunes. Have a great week.